ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And a big time card coming up this weekend. We have UFC Columbus coming up from, you guessed it, Columbus, Ohio. And it's not that often that major MMA heads to Ohio, but that's what you're getting. You had a fight night last weekend over in London. One of the best fight night cards in recent memory and a lot of top prospects popping off. But if you look at it coming up this weekend, 13 ranked fighters as of now, 9 of them in the top 10 in their respective divisions. It should be an absolute banger. And as always, one half your host to do it, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, I know this is headlined by another big heavyweight fight, but we have a little bit of a logjam en route to our interim heavyweight championship bout. Will Stipe Miocic continue to be a full-time fireman? He is, of course, from Ohio. Will he be in attendance? John Jones lurking about, I guess, but there's always rumors that he's in that conversation. But last weekend, Tom Aspinall with a huge first-round finish win over
second,
a very, very durable Alexander Volkov. You look at that fight, you look at this fight between Blades and Dawkins. Listen, you really proved something to those fans. You could really creep your way into that title shot.
Personally, I do feel like both these guys are almost half a step back of where our main event was of last weekend, because we were talking about it. We felt like the winner of Aspinall Volkov is probably next in line for the title shot. I feel like the winner of this fight probably will need one more kind of main event slot, co-main event slot, at least another big fight before they do get into the title picture, because you have to remember, Curtis Blaydes, for as good as he is, has lost quite a few times to these top contenders in the division. Now, be it, it's only against the craziest of crazy power punchers. And for Dawkins, coming off that tough loss over Derek Lewis, I feel like he will need more than just a good win over Curtis Blaydes. But, like we were talking about last weekend, it's nice that there's a division that's just active right now. I would much rather a slight logjam in the top 10 of a division where 8 of the top 10 fighters are all actively competing, instead of a weird logjam where you've got a bunch of people fighting once every 6, 7, 8 months like we had at lightweight for so many years. So I really like where the heavyweight division is right now, and there's some genuinely surprisingly good fights on this card. We were laughing about how, oh, you know, these fight nights, they don't have the best co-main events. Maybe this co-main event isn't the best, but like, Askarov Kai Kara France is a pay-per-view main card fight if there ever was one.
Well, let's throw it on over to our Fight Night Picks fight of the night screen and really talk about a couple that are just jumping off the page with both of us.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
And when you look at it coming up this weekend at welterweight, you know your weird Uncle Jim, he's going to be so excited for Matt Brown, who's taking on Brian Bam Bam Barbarina, because these two guys are here to bang. And for Matt Brown, he essentially, for all intents and purposes, retired Diego Lima after his last fight. I mean, it was a short right hand flash knockout. Lima's down, and it was an incredible scene and a big time win for Matt Brown. This fight was originally scheduled to take place a few months ago, but a couple things have happened since then. Barbarina took on a short notice Darian Weeks, and ultimately we do end up with this fight, but this one is a striker's paradise.
I don't think this is for your weird Uncle Jim. This is for your long-haired brother, Matt. I'd get up for a Matt Brown fight, because how could you not? Even at this stage of his career, I think he has proven that he's not just one of those wash fighters that you kind of give to guys because you expect them to lose. He can still bang with the best of them. And this fight against Brian Barbarina, I don't think anybody's telling themselves, wow, this is to get into the rankings. This is one of those fight of the night style fights that hopefully Dana White was watching our channel being like, the boys at Fight Night Picks would really appreciate Brian Barbarina versus Matt Brown, because I am as excited for this fight as I am for any in the first half of this year.
Oh, it's I'm going hard in this video later on in the show. You're not going to want to miss that one. When it comes to our second pick, you want to get me excited about a fight. Askar Askarov, my guy, the former ACB flyweight champ. He has a twister on his record. That much is true. He's going to be taking on the ever-dangerous Kai Kara France, a guy who, you look at the record, I mean, 23-9 with a no contest, but you really do consider everything that Kai Kara France has done, and he shot his shot after his last win over Cody Garbrandt, and he wanted the title shot. But ultimately, he is here against Askar Askarov. Not an easy fight for either man. You could consider it style versus style. I absolutely love this one.
You feel terrible for Askar Askarov, because it feels like he would be fighting for the title already if there wasn't a trilogy fight happening.
Making the weight.
And that really has been the unfortunate thing. It's been the weight misses. It's been the inactivity. It's been other things than his in-cage performances, which is really unfortunate. But that's why this fight against Kai Kara France is so much fun. Even if you beat someone like Kara France, it's not going to be an easy fight by any stretch of the imagination. So for Askar Askarov to be that fighter that we all think he can be one day, I really do think that this fight against Kai Kara France is going to tell us a ton about him.
Big time opportunity for both of these fighters in this one at flyweight to really knock down that door and try and get rid of the logjam that is between two fighters who want their fourth fight, maybe, with Moreno and Figueiredo. Let us know down below who you have in a possible fight of the night. We'd love to hear it from you down below in that comment section. And when we're looking at this card, 13 fights as of now, it seemed like maybe Tucker Lutz would get a short notice opponent as Sungwoo Choi was out, but again, from MMA Kings, Nolan King, it looks like that is not the case. We look up and down through this one. A lot of additions, a lot of subtractions. You had Jan Blachowicz, who was supposed to take on Alexander Rakic. That's been moved by a couple of months. You had Montel Jackson, who was supposed to take on Dana Bakary. Steps Chris Gutierrez at 135 pounds, but there's quite a bit of notice in that one. And, I mean, all said and considered, Abzupian Magomedov is out. In steps Dennis Tululin, who's been training with some big-time fighters, to take on Aliaskar Hizidiev. But Matt, I look at this card overall, it's one of those ones that you can get really excited about top to bottom.
Oh, how could you not? And like we were saying before, the heavyweight division right now is as hot as any, oddly enough, and we haven't really said that in a very long time. You've got fun new contenders, you've got sort of the old guard, if you will, in the top five, and guys like Chris Daukaus and Tom Aspinall last weekend, they're looking to break down that door like you had said. So I think this is going to be a phenomenal main event, and hopefully we do get just a little bit more clarity around that whole interim title deal, because like you said, Stipe could be in attendance, you've got John Jones sort of around in the background. Every fight in the heavyweight division right now seems to be a very important one, so I think this is a great main event.
And both of these guys in this main event ranked higher than the big-time winner from last weekend, Tom Aspinall, so a great opportunity all the way around, and a lot of pressure on these guys too, so you hope that they deliver. Make sure you check out Fight Night Picks ?Kicks. It's 2 hours before the prelims on Saturday. Next weekend, no UFC card, a little bit of R&R, maybe some different content out there, but a big time week nonetheless. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say, let's get into it. Couple of former regional standouts on the hunt for their next win. We have the 2021 LFA featherweight champ Bruno Tiger Souza taking on a Fight Ready MMA's Luis Saldana. And for the Tiger, he came in on about a week's notice taking on Melzik Bogdasarian, one of the best pure kickboxers you're going to find in MMA. And if you like Melzik Bogdasarian, you're really going to like Vyacheslav Borshev, who's also on this card. Slava Claus, really exciting fight that he has against the Bone Crusher, Mark Jacasey. But to get back to the fight that we have, I mean, for Bruno Souza, a week's notice, he was a plus 310 underdog. And if you look at that fight, unanimous decision win for Bogdasarian, all three judges scoring at 29-28, giving the third round to Bruno Souza. You like the way that he rallied in that fight. And for Souza, primarily known as more of a decision fighter, you look at it, he's 10-2 overall, seven of those wins by decision. And then you really equate in his fighting style. And this is a kid that got involved very, very young in karate. At the age of 4, he picks up the martial art. At the age of 12, he starts training at, I don't know, some random karate gym, you know, the Machida Academy with Lyoto and Shinzo and company. And then he ultimately makes the move to the States just a few years ago. Really rounds it out. He trains at California Mixed Martial Arts. Victor Henry, one of the guys at that gym, you saw him with a huge win over Hany Barcelos in his debut. He was around a plus 310 underdog too. And if you consider it as well, Weber Almeida, a guy that you gotta watch out for over with Bellator. I wish we get to see him fight more often. But for Bruno Souza, he kind of has a bit of a point karate type of fight to him. He really does like to stand on the outside, stands really tall, hands can kind of get a little low, and really starts to fight with his legs. And it's not something that we see all that often. And you might see some comparisons to Wonderboy Thompson, but for Bruno,
I think there's a middleweight that we could compare much better to him named Christoph Schottko, but continue.
When you look at Bruno Souza, with Wonderboy, he can switch stances. He can throw lead leg kicks from both stances. From Bruno, he likes to more so reset when he goes for his strikes, but out of the reset, there's really a big important key. A, there's always the cardio. So on the reset, he's always going to be fresh. But B, he loves the counter shots. And he is a really, really tricky fighter when you start to advance in on him. And the big thing with Bruno Souza, when you consider him and kind of compare him with Luis Saldana, oh, Saldana is a finisher. He really, really is to the nth degree. Only one fight that he's won has gone to decision. That was his UFC debut against Jordan Griffin. And in that fight, a chicka-chicka-chicka-chicka-choo-choo. He started to lose steam as that one went on. And then he takes on Austin Lingo's last time out, loses the decision. And the same thing happened. He got knocked down in the third round of that fight. So for Luis Saldana, he is not necessarily a one-hitter quitter. And he's great with his jiu-jitsu, with his striking. But again, only two fights that he's ever won gone to the third round. The one where he looked like a phoenix rising against Prince Murdoch on Dana White's Contender Series to book his ticket to the UFC. The other in 2012 against a young man named Zach Smith. First name spelled with two K's, like he's Zach Wild riffing on guitar. So Matt, when I look at this fight, really a contrast of styles, so to speak. Saldana can definitely strike. He is definitely game, that big front kick that he had against Murdoch. But again, a little bit more well-rounded when it comes to his ground game.
I still don't know if I'd say contrast of styles, though, because both guys are going to choose to strike in this fight, or at least I believe so, because with Souza, he does have that oddly unique style of, I'm a great striker, I'm just not the most powerful striker, and it is a very unique skill, because not a lot of fighters fight like that, and I don't think he has bad punching power by any stretch of the imagination. He just really needs to lead you into his combinations and set a lot of traps on the feet, which against someone like Saldana is going to be very difficult to do, because he himself is such a high-level striker. It'd be a little bit different if Bruno Souza was fighting, just pick any wrestler, really, someone who isn't a natural striker, who will at least question themselves on the feet a little bit more, who might not know when to enter and when to get out of the pocket, whereas
like a re-return from BKFC Chad Mendes. There's the fight to make.
Chad Mendes would destroy both these guys in the same night. Luis Saldana, though, is someone who will go to the leg quite often, especially with his kicks. And I think that's going to be a really big point in this fight, because if Saldana can slow down the movement of Bruno Souza, it's going to make him that much more available to hit. And like you had said earlier, if these guys do start to find themselves into those 50-50 exchanges to where Souza isn't the one being elusive and forcing Saldana to miss and overextend, that's when Souza's going to be a sitting duck as these combinations start to fly. So I really do think early on that footwork is going to be key, but for Souza, actually the clinch is going to be oddly important in this fight, because he's going to need a way on the inside to negate some of the attacks like the knees and the elbows of Saldana. So I actually think Bruno Souza is going to have the game plan of, I'm either all the way out, like we see Wonderboy when he fought Vicente Luque, a lot of counters, not really being the one engaging in the pocket, or all the way in. So the second they do start to engage in that kickboxing boxing range, I could see Souza close that distance, try to clinch up, just so he doesn't give Saldana any extension on his punches, because at the kickboxing range, I think Souza can have success. He's got great movement. He himself has great kicks. But I do think that the second this takes a half step closer and it does become more of a Muay Thai, more of a boxing fight, that's when it does heavily favor Saldana, mainly because of his finishing potential.
Well, that's it. I look at this fight, and this really is a Zed and Marin Morris, why don't you just meet me in the middle type of fight? Because again, both guys, long range weapons, straight up the middle. It's not like they're throwing big looping hooks and trying to close distance like Dana Bakary, who's on this card. The other thing that we can consider, again, we know how good Bruno Souza is, 2015 world champion in karate. For Luis Saldana, he's a 2009 Iowa Gold Gloves champ, so he does have that in his back pocket. A little bit of a reach, a little bit of a snag. But when we do look at the odds for this fight, it actually opened at par. Saldana slightly favored right now at a minus 120. Bruno Souza somewhere in around a minus 105. And a little bit of inside the curtain, inside baseball, behind the fourth wall, I didn't look at any of the odds for this card before I wrote this one down before this fight. So again, that was a big surprise to me, to be completely honest, because if we're looking at the Tapology votes, we keep those a surprise every time. I'm going to say over under 70% Saldana in this one.
I think they'll be closer to 50-50.
Thinking nope. They're going to be closer to 50-50 right there.
Kind of right.
879 total votes. 74% Souza, 75% by decision for the 26% that have Saldana, 77% by decision. And again, for Souza, you look at it, the 5-1-in wins over Kamwell Kirk by split decision, super close fight. Knockout win over Guillerme Santos, a split decision win over Elijah Johns, and a win over Javier Garcia by decision to win that LFA belt. That one was back about, 6 months ago? So it hasn't been that long. The fight against Melzik about 4 months ago. For Saldana, good level competition outside of the UFC primarily was losing to the better fighters that he was taking on. But Matt, when it comes to this one, we set it up a couple of different ways for both these guys. Who do you have winning this one?
So, this is the big key for both guys, and it's cardio. Souza has very good cardio, and Saldana, if he does have a big Achilles heel, I would say it is his cardio. Maybe wrestling defense when he fights upper echelon guys, but we don't really need to worry about that in this fight. This is the problem. If you're fighting someone who has poor cardio, you should be the one pressuring them, because when I'm pressuring you, it's going to force you to be active too. And when you're active, and if you have a bad gas tank, it's going to force you to burn that gas very fast. Souza's not really an aggressive fighter though, so I think he's going to let Saldana fight at a pace that's comfortable to Saldana. So unless Luis is just finding himself missing a lot in the middle of the cage, I think he's going to be able to fight at his own pace, which hopefully won't tire him out. And if he is able to just keep a more sustained pace throughout 15 minutes, I think this is a great fight for him to win, because again, it's only going to be contested on the feet, or primarily will be, and if anyone takes it to the ground, it's probably going to be Saldana actually. So I do think with him being the more well-rounded guy and the more powerful guy, and hopefully, or I think he will be allowed to fight at his own pace, I like Saldana in this matchup.
Well, the craziest part about this one, for Saldana, he is 1-2 in the UFC, has that wild win on Contender Series, the one win that he has over Jordan Griffin. You go back and watch it and you go, Luis Saldana won that fight? Like, are you actually kidding me? MMA decisions, 2 had it, 29-28 Saldana, 16 had it, 29-28 Griffin, and the UFC went, see you later, Jordan Griffin, don't care how close that fight was, but really it was.
He had lost like 4 in a row. Though.
Round 1 and round 3, Griffin was able to win. Round 2 was Saldana. So again, I do expect the forward pressure out of Saldana. I do expect him to mix it up in this fight. I do have Luis Saldana to get the win, but again, very, very close one, so let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this battle at 145 pounds. Both of us going with Phoenix's own Luis Saldana, or at least the adopted son of Phoenix Saldana, to get the win. And a big time card coming up, headlined by Curtis Blaydes taking on Chris Daukaus. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time UFC debut between a couple of guys whose combined age is 64. You know I love that. Coming up at middleweight, it's fire with fire. We have the Black Wolf, Ali Askab Hazriyev, taking on Dennis Tallulin. And he has a very, very interesting career, does Tallulin. You go over it, he's been training at Extreme Couture. You look at the pics over on the Instagrams, and there are some big names. Looks like he's befriended the bad boy of the division, Sean Strickland, so there is that. But overall, when I look at this fight, I mean, Ali Askab Hazriyev was supposed to debut 4 times last year. Like, I look at the names, too, and it's really kind of crazy when you do consider it, because we had done a video about his fight against Kyle Daukaus, and we will throw it back to that one to give you a bit of a better idea of who Ali Askab Hazriyev is. But when you do look at the names, Kyle Daukaus, Wellington Turman, Alessio Di Chirico, and this weekend he was supposed to be taking on Avzupian Magomedov. Tallulin will be replacing him on what seems like a few weeks' notice. So interesting that way. But overall, when I look at this one, let's throw it on back, first of all, to that fight that Hazriyev was supposed to have against Kyle Daukaus. It would have been, again, you talk fire with fire in the grappling sense of things. Then we'll update it with this fight that we have coming up this weekend. Ali Askab Hazriyev, a guy that's been on a lot of people's radars for really the longest time. I mean, he beat Paul Harris, you know, who's smart Paul Harris, back in 2018. You want to see a good fight. You want to see a guy get killed. Usmar Palharis goes over there to Russia, thinks, hey, I'm juicy AF. I'm going to beat this guy. Gets hit clean, gets dropped. Now, did he pull guard? Maybe he did, but he got finished. And listen, could Ali Askab Hazriyev go out there and have a career like Emil Mech? Maybe he does. However, when I watch this guy fight, it gets me up in the morning, if I'm telling you, and if I'm being totally honest. Like, this is the type of Sunday morning stuff that I get up about. And for Ali Askab Hazriyev, you look at it. He'll throw a high kick with his lead leg. He'll throw a high kick with his back leg. Really long-rangey southpaw. He throws kicks to the body. He works very fast. There's so many fights that you can go back and watch. The Matei Trujan fight is the one that I like for Fight Nights Global 62, where he throws a kick. You see Trujan just kind of drop his hand down. And then Kasariev goes, I don't care about your hand that's down. I'm going to throw a punch there. Drops him. And then soccer kicks him for good effect. After that, beats Yasube Inamoto by decision. I like that, the 3-round experience. Beats Usmar Palharis, then takes over 2 years off. He takes 2.5 years off. He fights Enrique Shigemoto over on Contender Series, and it's just more of the same. The guy just goes absolutely total explosiveness. It worries me against a lot of fighters. It worries me in this fight against Kyle Daukaus.
But the guy is super explosive, super athletic.
I do think Kizriev is the faster of the two. And if he is very dedicated to his kicking game and staying on the outside, you mentioned the body kicks. If he's just dedicated to the leg kick from the outside, take away some of that range and some of the footwork of Daukus and force him to become a striker. Because we all know how good the grappling of Kyle Daukus is. It's not like he's a poor striker by any means. But if this fight is completely contested on the feet, I like Kizriev quite a bit.
Kizriev. Wow. Like, again, you want to go back and have a fun trip through the highlight reels. Not highlight reels. You watch the full fights, but they're only, you know, 2.5 minutes, 30 seconds. It pretty much is a highlight reel. It's a lot of fun. 5 wins by knockout, 3 by submission, 5 by decision for Kizriev. So with Kizriev, he's probably one of the more fun fighters that I've seen kind of making that debut into the UFC. Obviously, we talked about Rinat Fardinov, who's supposed to make his UFC debut, and these guys train together at American Top Team, so that's really interesting. But when it comes to Tallulah, when I did my research, you watch him fight and you go from, you know, him fighting guys that are debuting to him fighting guys that actually have a record, and he fights the same damn way. And I'll let you take over.
I'm really glad that you said that, because I know later on, and anybody who watches this channel knows, I love Matt the Immortal Brown. I do. Matt Brown at this stage of his career is a 50-50 fighter, to where if he lands that big shot, he's going to win because he still hits really hard. But when you're known for getting into crazy fights and now you're 40, your level of durability is going to get chipped away at over time. So now if you land on Brown, he will also go down. You get the idea. He lands first, he wins. He gets hit first, he loses. Tallulah, I think, is going to fall into that category, and it's concerning because he's making his UFC debut right now. He's going to fall into that 50-50 category because he is an absurdly aggressive striker, to the point where every time he does go in and throw his flurries, I know you're going to get to more of that in a little bit, he does leave himself very open. Now, do you like the aggression? Is the punching power good? Yes, but here's my issue with his overall striking game. There's not a lot of variety to it. With someone like Zabit Magomedsharipov, we talk about how, you know, he probably does a little bit too much, right? He could slow it down a little bit, maybe do some more traditional combos, and his cardio would look better later on in fights. Tallulah goes out there, throws combos, a lot of 1-2s, but he either spams a ton of hooks or throws a bunch of 1-2s up the middle. He's not somebody who will switch his combinations, kind of mid-combinations, switch his footwork, and I know these are things that we normally talk about when we talk about people up in the rankings, but still, you're making your UFC debut against Kizriev, who we talked about before is somebody who we could honestly see beating Kyle Daukus in his UFC debut. That's how good of a fighter this is, and I'm really glad that you brought up the three opponents that he was matched up with going into this one. Because those are three pretty good fighters. I would say Alessio De Chirico, although he's not the best guy in the world, is still sort of an above average UFC debut level guy. And same thing with Daukus. So that really tells you how much stock the matchmakers put into Kizriev as a prospect, because he can grapple, he can strike. Is he a little undersized for the division? Yes, and that does worry me when he does start to fight, you know, more experienced guys or at least bigger guys in the division. But for right now against Tallulah on short notice, this is a very, very good fight for Kizriev.
So I look at this one and, all right, for Denis Tallulah, I mean, he hasn't been knocked out since 2013. So that's pretty cool. You do like to see that. You like to go into the weeds a little bit. We don't, but you can. So out of his 10 wins, combined opponent record is 25-29. 5 of those 10 fighters were winless. So there is that. And then you look at his 5 losses, the opponent's record 27-4. So anybody good that he's fought, he's lost to, and anybody that's not very good, you know, he's been able to beat. Now, his last win was about a year ago over Gislano Fajeia, who was 11-2, so that does add to that. But again, if you take 11-2 off of that, it's 14-27, so it's not that great. And for Tallulah, this fight was announced on March 9th, so he does get a few weeks to get ready for it. I said he's training over at Extreme Couture. Gabriel Checo lost to Rashad Evans recently in that camp, so but you will get some of the grappling out of him. That's why I mention it. Chris Curtis, you also have Duraev, who I love, and then you also have Sadibusi, who's going to give you that really long kickboxing range at 185 or thereabouts. But again, I look at this one, I mean, if you even consider Fajeia, he was 35 years old in that fight at 11-2, so I do discount it a little bit. His walkout is also can't stop. That's TJ Dillashaw's walkout. Don't ever take it. Like, you're getting me overly excited, and I don't love it. The other thing, and I mean, I look at Denis Tallulah, it's almost like watching a kid playing Rock'em Sock'em Robots and just mashing on it, or you've got some baseball fan from Southie at a Red Sox game, like, come on, pitcher. Hey, batter. Strike him the fuck out. Like, just yelling in his ear, because for Tallulah, like, he'll go 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, back out, and then throw, like, one leg kick. And then wait there. And then throw a hook. And then 1-2, 1-2. Like, it really is a game plan that I see him struggling with against not even ranked fighters in the UFC.
He's 10-5 and he's 34 making his UFC debut on short notice.
2 months away from 34.
Against somebody who we genuinely believe is like an exciting prospect of this division. Now, again, I keep on going back to Kislyaev's more ceiling more than anything with this fight because I do expect him to win this matchup, if I'm being completely honest. I think he's the more well-rounded fighter. I think he's the more dynamic fighter on the feet, especially. And if he is able to take it to the mat, which I do think he will at some point, he has shown a very high level of activity even on the ground. He's not someone who's just going to stall out. He will pass your guard. He will try to go for a lot of submissions too. I just want to know how much his size is going to affect him. And the thing about Tallulah is that he's not a small guy by any means. So if he can wear on Ali Askab, especially early on, let's say he can clinch up early. Maybe not make this fight, you know, a fight of the night contender, but just wear on him. Use your physicality. I think it'll be interesting to see how that does play out as this fight goes on. But if we're just breaking down who's the more skilled fighter, I don't think anybody would say Tallulah's the more skilled fighter than Kislyaev. And that's why I've got to pick Ali Askab.
You look at the odds in this one. Kislyaev open a minus 300 favorite. He's a minus 430. Or thereabouts on best fight odds. For Tallulah, open a plus 240. He's now a plus 330 or thereabouts. And for his name, I watched M1. I watched Brave. Everybody said Tallulah. It looks very, very daunting for an English speaker. But listen, that's what they said on those broadcasts. That's what I've gone with. And if we look at the topology votes, I don't anticipate they're going to be close at all, Matt. Let me set them.
I'm going to say ahead. 83%
over. I was going to say 90. Yeah, wow, look at that. Okay. Not close. 847 total votes. 96% Kislyaev. 57% by submission, 20% by knockout. For the 4% that have Tallulah, 52% by knockout. I think that's the only way he's going to win. Like, again, he is the taller fighter. Reach is somewhat close. Kislyaev's one of those guys. Like, it's like Alexander Romanov with, like, the sumo and the sambo. And then you pair that with the striking of, like, I don't know, a wildcat. If a wildcat, like, I know it's a high school mascot nickname in every town over, but when I look at the way that Kislyaev strikes, like, it's wild, it's unorthodox, it's kind of crazy. It leaves him susceptible to where he could get hit by Tallulah, who has good power. I should say that, too. He does actually have very good power, but he's way too wild. And the other thing is, he's a kickboxer who holds his hands way up here. And when you're a kickboxer to hold your hands way up here, you either get taken down, or if you decide I'm going to hold them down and I'm going to try and defend the takedowns, you're leaving yourself to getting hit. So I don't like Tallulah in this fight at all. I'm never very strong this way or the other way about some of these fights, but I have the Black Wolf here big time.
Yeah, no, he's by far the more skilled fighter. Again, size of the future, I do think is going to be an issue for him. Kislyaev's the type of guy who could probably win 6 fights in a row, look really good, then get knocked out by Uriah Hall in the 3rd round of a fight. Like, that's the type of career he could have. Uriah Hall could do that to anybody, to be fair, but I do think he'll be able to win this one.
If Tallulah wins, I'll do a hot sauce shoey out of one of the Air Jordans behind me. It is a fight that's going to happen this weekend. I'm going to watch it, though, with Pop and Popcorn. Kislyaev, big-time favorite in this matchup. Let us know who you have. Down below in the comments section, maybe you're a buddy of Dennis Tallulah. We've offended you. We have a big-time card coming up. You have Curtis Blaydes taking on Kyle Daukaus in the main event. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Possible fight of the night contender. Coming up this weekend, we have top 10 ranked flyweights battling it out. It's The Undertaker, Dave Dvorak, representing Czech Republic, taking on Brazil's Matheus Nicolau. And for Nicolau, he's one of those guys that you went, if we're doing the flyweight purge, are we really getting rid of Nicolau? Like, is he really the guy that we want to get rid of? And for him, I mean, he was able to get some wins outside of the promotion. He comes back into the UFC. He beats the former Ryzen champ in Manel Kopp, albeit by split decision. It was a close fight. We can get into it later. But his last time out, he had another close enough fight against Tim Elliott. It was a lot of fun. There was a lot of fun in it. He's taking on David Dvorak that is undefeated in his last number of fights. And it's a tidy little win streak that he brings into this one, especially when you consider the guys that he's beaten in the UFC. And I know his last time out, it was only Juan Camilo Ronderos on incredibly short notice. But a win over Bruno Silva, win over Jordan Espinoza, and then the finish over Ronderos where he kind of had his way in it. I would hope so, though. He was just, like, swinging his right hand out there, and Ronderos kind of, like, missed a step. Dvorak just big brothered him, took his back, and just choked him out. And Ronderos wasn't even fighting the arm. Like, he was just kind of, like, hanging out. Looked like he was all good. And then the submission was good. But really, when we look at David Dvorak and we consider his really his performances that he had outside of the UFC with Octagon, with the other promotions, and we consider the guy inside of the UFC, no major changes, still the same guy, still going to implement his grappling, still going to implement a really fan-friendly type of striking style, doesn't take a ton of damage. And the big thing that we saw out of Dvorak, especially in the Jordan Espinoza fight, he made him switch stances with the amount of leg kicks and the thunder that he threw on those leg kicks. You love to see that, especially in this division.
Oh, of course. Now, the dangerous thing about standing a kicking range with someone like Mateusz Nicolau, though, is that, A, he also has phenomenal leg kicks himself, but Nicolau has a really unique way of throwing his punches. He's got this looping, like, way that he throws them. It's almost like a Nate Diaz-esque shot, where it's not a straight, it's not a hook. It's sort of a slapping straight, if you will, and it really catches a lot of guys off guard because he is so big for this weight class. But the thing about Dvorak, and I agree with everything you've said, he has the skills, he just hasn't had the chance to showcase it against top tier UFC talent yet. And that's why I think this fight is so fun, because if you just take the talent that is Dvorak and you don't really take into account his level of competition up until this point, you're pretty excited about the prospect we have. Well, prospect, he's under 30, so we can still hit him with that moniker, I guess. With Nicolau, it's weird because he's been around for a while now. Like you said, this is second run in the UFC. He was an exciting top 15 guy for a little while. But the weird thing about Nicolau is that he has good but not great cardio. He has good but not great punching power. It just feels like he lacks an X factor. And yes, I would say he has above average punching power for this weight class, without a doubt. But it's not so high to the level of like a Devis Figueiredo or a Pantoja, to where every time they land on your opponent, you genuinely think they could put him out. With Nicolau, he does rely a little bit more on his combinations. And that'll be very interesting to see in this fight, because with Dvorak, he loves to pressure guys backwards. He really does like to keep his hands high for someone who wrestles a lot, which is interesting because, like you had said earlier, with the kickboxer leaving their hands high,
Dennis Tallulin.
Thank you. With Dennis Tallulin, Dvorak will keep his hands high, but it's in a very intelligent manner. He's someone who's very quick with his own takedown entries, so he can shoot in very fast. So it's not really a detriment to him at all, or a weakness. I should look at that as a big strength for David Dvorak. But again, I worry about him at the long range in this fight, because for as good as he is, and he's got great ground and pound, we haven't even talked, his elbows on the ground are disgusting. He's got them from half guard, full guard. Just, he's really, really good, especially with his ground and pound. But Nicolau is never really in a set position, especially on the mat. He's got a great defensive guillotine, but he can get held down sometimes, and I do think Dvorak will have a lot of success if he does decide to wrestle early, because with Nicolau, really that was the story on him in his first UFC tenure. It was, you don't want to strike with this guy, you really just want to try to take him down. But the weird thing, and I keep on going back to this and I'll hand it back off, Nicolau doesn't have the best chin for a big power puncher, and it's weird because in this division, there's not a ton of one-punch knockout artists by any means. I know, talk about Figueiredo, talk about Pantoja, but I would say those are pretty much the only guys. Nicolau, he hasn't been knocked out cold a lot in his career, but he gets dropped or at least wobbled in every single fight he has ever been in. And that really does worry me against someone like Dvorak, who, if he wobbles you early, that avalanche is going to keep on coming and coming and coming.
And it's really weird when you consider this fight at flyweight and the featherweight fight that kicks off this card. Luis Saldana taking on Bruno Souza, because Souza has great cardio. Saldana doesn't necessarily. And Saldana can really give away the later stages of a fight. When you look at it for Mateusz Nicolau, his cardio is not that bad. He does get hit, but the trouble that I have, he's in the same boat as Saldana. Saldana arguably, very arguably, lost his UFC debut. It's a win on his record, and then his last time out, he loses to Austin Lingo. For Mateusz Nicolau, he fights Manel Kopp, and 22, all 22, everybody on MMA Decision scored at 29-28 for Manel Kopp. But for Mateusz Nicolau, did he win the first round? Did he win the third round? And then you look at his last fight against Tim Elliott, and the thing that we know, he's able to get the win there because he loses the first round, and he rallies in round two and round three. So in this fight against David Dvorak, I don't necessarily think we're going to get a finish in this one. I don't. I think it's going to just be a great fight, one that everybody can get excited about. But again, it's really going to come down to who can be the more active guy in the cage and who can really, really implement their footwork. Because if you look at it, David Dvorak's always doing something. He's always moving out of the way. He's always doing something. It's not wasted movement, though. And for Nicolau, good L-step, good in and out. Like, that really is where his bread gets buttered. So when I do consider this fight, you look at the odds. Not surprisingly, they actually open a par. Dvorak's slight favorite right now, minus 138 on best fight odds. Nicolau somewhere around a plus 113. We have a look over on Tapology. The votes are a surprise to us, there to you. And I don't even know where to go with this one. I'm going to say 60% over under Dvorak.
I was about to say, I'm going to say over.
So it is over 921 total votes, actually 79% Dvorak, 83% by decision for the 21% that I'm Nicolau, 74% by decision. And I mean, I look at this one, Dvorak doesn't have as much UFC experience. We know that. Nicolau had the two different stints. Dvorak is the more active fighter by the numbers, but again, level of competition, not quite there. And you consider it. The last guy that he fought, Juan Camilo Ronderos, came in on a day's notice and missed weight for that fight and was a 4-0 fighter taking on a man. A man! Like, Dvorak, you said, like, he's a prospect, but again, he's under 30, he's got 23 fights. He's a man! You don't give 4-0 guys men in the octagon. So, Matt, when I look at this fight, again, line close, it is a good fight. What do you say?
Here's the thing. I know we've set this up as, oh, if Dvorak can just get this to the ground, he's going to have a lot of success. And I think that's true. I genuinely think he's going to eat a lot of damage, though, before he gets it to the ground. Because that's the kind of striker Nicolau is. And maybe we haven't set it up all that well for Nicolau, because he can. When he puts his combinations together, it's a really, really hard just flurry to stop. And for Dvorak, he's going to need his wrestling to stop the forward momentum of Nicolau. So I think if he does get the takedown, he'll have a ton of success. But if Nicolau could just defend the first two or three and force Dvorak to be a striker, I do think Nicolau could find himself winning this fight. Although, the official prediction will be David Dvorak. I do think he will be able to get it down to the mat. And if he can just grapple with Nicolau a lot early on, really wear on him, I think the gas tank of Nicolau is a big enough issue for him to where if the fight's close early on, Dvorak can start to separate himself as it goes on.
And Nicolau, for what it is worth, in that UFC tenure, 92% takedown defense. Elliott was able to get one his last fight out. Nicolau
so
was
long.
Able to get one. He is really long, and he has great defensive hips. He has really, really good clinch control, and so does Dvorak. When I look at this one, Nicolau, is he the harder puncher? More than likely so. Again, not a lot of knockout wins in the UFC, a lot more outside of it. But again, Douglas Silva, Deion Jarosz in that category.
Nicolau bangs, though.
You get up for his fights, just like you do for Nicolau's. I like the activity out of Dvorak. I like the fact that he's always going for something. He's always forcing a clinch. It's always on his terms, or at least it has been in 20 of his 23 fights. So really, when you go back through, you do the tape study. For me, I have Dvorak in this one, but it is such a good fight. And listen, I wouldn't be surprised if Brazil's Nicolau is able to pull out the win. This is one of my favorite fights coming up this weekend. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight, both of us going with Czech Republic's own David Dvorak to get the win. Big time card coming up. Joanne Wood taking on Alexa Grasso in the co-main event. Curtis Blades taking on Chris Daukaus. You're not going to want to miss it. Just keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
And as it were, Montel Jackson is out of his bout to take on Dana Bakary. But it was announced by Tom Feely of Sherdog on February the 14th that in steps El Guapo, Chris Gutierrez, and Matt. Really, when you look at this, I mean, nuts and bolts, this is a fun fight. I would have been down for Montel Jackson.
Of course.
You talk about a fighter that bangs. I mean, Montel Jackson, get it done on the feet for sure. But he's got great jiu-jitsu as well. And when you look at Chris Gutierrez, this is the way that I look at it. I mean, is he the candidate for Sean O'Malley's uncrowned king of the unranked at this point? I mean, you look at it, like, in the UFC, he loses to Jaime Barcelos in his debut, and since then, he hasn't lost a damn fight. Like, yeah, he lost a first-round 10-8 to Cody Durden in a short-notice debut, but since the Barcelos fight, win over McDonald, win over DeFreitas, win over Vince Morales, win over Andre Yule, win over Felipe Collares. And again, for Gutierrez, the only thing that's really kind of bugged me is we don't get to see him fight more often.
And it is unfortunate, but this is a great short notice matchup for Dana. Like, normally you get this fighter coming in, you don't really know that much. No, we're getting Chris Gutierrez, who is a really good striker, and that's the thing. This could have been on the Fight of the Night screen, if we're being honest, because stylistically, these guys' styles do play into each other. With Dana Bakary, where do we start with his striking? He has absurd power for his frame, and he still knows a really unique style of striking too. I wouldn't say they're a pure boxer, I wouldn't say they're a pure kickboxer. He uses elbows on the inside, but he also, he's very boxing heavy, don't get me wrong. He's not necessarily like a Cub Swanson or a Dominic Cruz where you'd say, wow, if I saw a silhouette of them, I'd know exactly who it is. But he does have quite a few skills that set him apart. And this recent run that he's been on, where he's really been able to uptick his aggression, has just paid off in droves. And it'll be really interesting to see how he fights Chris Gutierrez, because both guys have a lot of success from the exact same range, and that is their boxing range. But the difference is that Gutierrez is going to use his low kicks and use his body kicks to then set up his boxing so he can have more success with his hands. I always go back to the Andre Yule fight, because that's pretty much the perfect fight to show a kicker how to just beat a boxer who moves really well on their feet, because Oh, is Andre Yule the best fighter in the UFC? No, but
no
again.
No longer, no.
He's a unique fighter who had a very, like I said, unique style to him. He was a boxer, had a long range. Gutierrez, early on, struggled punching him. He couldn't really get in range. And then decided to just start chopping those legs down. And he went to the legs. He went to the body. He even went to the head with those kicks. And as those kicks started to pile up, you could tell the movement of Andre Yule went from, like, Sean O'Malley levels in the first round to, like, I don't know, data 5,000 levels in the third round. It was a big drop-off, and it was 100% attributed to those leg kicks. But that's what I worry about with Chris Gutierrez. It's sort of what I go back to when I said Chael Sonnen, when he knew he had to fight Michael Bisping, he thought, okay, I just have to eliminate the jab, because that's how he sets everything else up. So I don't need to worry about all of his crazy combinations if I can just deal with the jab. Do you think when fighters fight Chris Gutierrez, that's all they're really telling themselves? They go, okay, if defensively, I can watch it for the leg kicks. Yes, he's a talented fighter. Yes, he has more skills. But that's such a big part of his game that if you can eliminate that one area, it does make the fight against Gutierrez quite a bit easier.
Well, that's it. I mean, you look at it, the Vince Morales win. How often do we see a TKO due to leg kicks? And then he goes out and fights Cody Durden. Now, that was on super short notice. Durden wrestles. And then Gutierrez rallies, wins the second and the third. Against Andre Yule, it was leg kicks that made the big difference. Against Felipe Claris, he outstruck him. He got out-wrestled a little bit. But again, split decision on his record. Say what you will about the fight. I thought Gutierrez went and won that one on the rewatch. But when I look at this one, Danah Bakary, you talk about it, elbows on the inside. Danah constantly pressures, and when you become a reactive fighter against him, like a Natividad, or pick anybody else, I mean, really, even in the Brandon Davis fight, Danah didn't give him an inch, and he just goes out there and throws odd punches, like really odd punches. We talked about it odd angles earlier on in the night, but when you look at it from Danah, again, left hook, he has two left hook knockout wins back-to-back.
They're
really
disgusting.
Quick. Guido Canetti, who looked great against Chris Moutinho here recently, but also the win over Natividad. When you watch him fight against Brandon Davis, Davis is one of those guys. It's volume, it's cardio, it's pace. And when Danah fights him, he doesn't give him a second. He just pours the pressure on him early on, and he's going like right hook to close the distance, overhand right. He's throwing a quick left hook. Like, there are so many things to like about him in his striking, and he's not the most susceptible to the kicks, but again, you say that, and then you fight a guy like Chris Gutierrez, it really does switch things up.
I do think, though, just a result of his range being in that boxing distance is going to eliminate some of those kicks of Gutierrez. Now, when they are in the open space, and when Bakary is trying to figure out, okay, how do I enter on, you know, the different strikes of Gutierrez, it's going to be tough, and those leg kicks are going to accumulate early. But to me, it becomes, when does Bakary decide, I'm just going to stay in the pocket? Because if you're in the pocket, leg kicks are really hard to throw when you're chest-to-chest with a person, unless your name's Justin Gaethje. He's pretty much the only guy in the UFC who throws those weird, like, kind of top-down leg kicks from the clinch. He's very unique in that capacity. Gutierrez has good leg kicks, but again, they're more from that traditional sense. He likes the calf kick, he likes the thigh kick from the kickboxing range. I think with Danah constantly being on the inside, though, throwing that left hook to the body, throwing that overhand right, it's not going to give Gutierrez time to set up with his strikes. Now, if this fight goes late, I actually do think Gutierrez has a better cardio out of these two guys, just because I've seen him later on in fights a lot more. I know it's a position he's a lot more comfortable in, so I'm a lot more comfortable telling you that I think Gutierrez has the better cardio out of these two, but I don't know if he's going to be able to make it to the third round, because he is a hittable fighter. He is someone who will kind of throw his hands down when he throws his leg kick, and that's going to be a big problem when you're fighting someone like Danah Bakary.
When I look at this one, short notice nature, throw it out the window. It's not that short notice. It's a month and a half, so you almost have the full 6 weeks, really. Well, you do have the full 6 weeks, so it's not that short notice. And when you look at the odds for this one, Gutierrez opened to plus 130, still roughly there. For Bakary, Danah, he opened to minus 150. He's still roughly there. So we have a look at the top apology votes. Surprise to us, they are to you. And right there, 914 total votes, 61% for Bakary Danah, 65% by knockout for the 39% that have Gutierrez, 80% by decision. And when we look at it for Bakary, I mean, he does have a fight of the night against Alatang Haley. It was, you know, a great fight. It really was. Both guys wearing it by the end of that fight. When I look at this one, though, again, for Bakary Danah, training out of Jackson Wink, 3-1 in the UFC, and ultimately, yeah, he swings souvenir mini bats all the time from all totally different angles. He can windmill them. He can really have some fun. For Gutierrez, yeah, throws a ton of kicks, and we've really kind of been feeding a fed horse with that one. Way more experience with Chris Gutierrez, pro and amateur. 10-2 as an amateur, 17-3-1 as a pro. Outside of the UFC, fights with Timur Valiyev, won a win, won a loss. Aaron Phillips, Ray Rodriguez, Jimmy Flick. And I think the team at Factory X is going to have a great game plan in there for Gutierrez to get the win in this one, to go into the later rounds, to wrestle. Now, could I see him having one of those Alexander Hernandez-esque fights in this one where he gets a little tired, he gets a little sloppy, he gets knocked out by Bacari? 100% I could. But in this one, I like Gutierrez, especially as an underdog in the spot.
Gutierrez just drops his hands when he throws kicks, though. And with someone like Dana, who is really good at countering, and his timing is so good, and he has genuine one-punch knockout power, I don't think that's the skill you want to have, especially if you're going to be throwing those kicks in close. And that's why I think Dana is going to be able to counter over the top and land a big hook. So that's why I've got Bacari.
Both of us in disagreement on this one, but we got to admit. I mean, it's either Bacari is going to go out there and knock his blocks off, or Gutierrez just lasts and lasts and lasts like the cat that came back the very next day. It should be a great fight coming up this weekend. I can't wait for this one. Like we said, it could be a possible fight of the night as well. Big time main event coming up. Doc is taking on the man himself, Curtis Blaydes. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, we have a big-time bantamweight clash, and one of these women, a 2004 silver medalist in freestyle wrestling, the other sent former title challenger Betch Kohea into retirement. It is Carol Hossa taking on Sarah McMahon.
What's a bigger accomplishment, do you think?
Betch had a lot of promo for that fight, and I don't know why they made it, because it was very, very silly. And for Carol Hossa, you look at it, undefeated in the UFC, split decision, all volume fight against Lara Procopio, able to defend the takedown. She beats Vanessa Mello, somebody who fought and didn't know she was pregnant at one point in her lifetime. Gets a win over Jocelyn Edwards, implements the wrestling, but also gets taken down. The only person to take her down, and she has over 90% takedown defense in her four UFC fights, and then the win over Betch Kohea that wasn't very close. Now, for Sarah McMahon, former title challenger, we know this, you know this, 5-6 in the UFC, and it's been a rocky road. I mean, 1-3 in her last four. I go back to her fight against Gina Mazzani, a big win.
How could I forget?
Exactly, and we can delve into that
one. Now, Mazzani missed weight and accepted it on a week's notice, so let's admit that too, but
that much is true. But I mean, for McMahon, she gets a win in her UFC debut. She challenges Ronda Rousey. When it comes to this fight, Matt, we look at Sarah McMahon, and again, last time outs gets submitted by your champion, Juliana Pena, in the third round. A win over Lena Landsberg, the elbow queen. A loss to Marion Renault. A loss to Ketlin Vieira. And a fight against Gina Mazzani that was 5 years ago. So Sarah McMahon, not the most active fighter, but you know exactly what you're going to get out of her every single damn time. It's going to be a lot of arm triangle choke attempts. It's going to be, realistically, when you look at it for Sarah McMahon, it is wrestle, wrestle, wrestle all the time.
Wrestle, 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 and no defensive jiu-jitsu whatsoever. And that really is the story about Sarah McMahon. She is such a physically dominant wrestler when she's able to implement her own will, but defensively, she's always left a lot to be desired, and that really has been her issue throughout her whole entire career, just the submission defense. And let's be honest, it's more the striking defense too, because with Sarah McMahon, offensively, she's a really good fighter. She has decent boxing combinations. She really is a Team Alpha Male fighter, which is weird to say. Sarah McMahon, you wouldn't think of someone who goes to Team Alpha Male, but really likes to wrestle, really likes to box, similar to that Extreme Couture style. But the issue with McMahon was, defensively with her striking and with her grappling, I just never really know where I should put her, even when she was in her prime, because when she was the one on top, using a ground and pound, she's so physically strong compared to most women in this division. Like, you would look at her opponents and be like, well, they're never getting out from under her. She had that Gregor Gillespie type of a style. But then you look at the Ketlin Vieira fight. And yes, Ketlin is a phenomenal grappler. We're not taking anything away from her. But Sarah McMahon, like you said, is an Olympic silver medalist wrestler. She's also a very good grappler, so we have very high standards for her as well. She gets top position, goes for the arm triangle choke, can't get it, and then Vieira immediately sweeps her, gets on top, and chokes her out with that exact same choke. And she could have choked her with a rear naked choke. It's not just the fact that she used the same submission that McMahon was going for. It's just that you can't go from getting a dominant submission and being in the position to get the submission to getting submitted only a minute later. And that really has been the story about Sarah McMahon throughout her career. Great wrestler when she's on top, but the second the roles get reversed and she does find herself on her back, she's not great at getting back up to her feet, which is kind of odd, because even with Yoel Romero, somebody we talked about a lot for his offensive grappling, even if he got taken down, he popped back up to his feet like it was nothing. Go back and watch the Chris Weidman fight. Talking way more about Yoel than I thought I would, but two really good wrestlers. And when Weidman would take Yoel down, it was like he had springs on his back. He'd jump right back up to his feet. With McMahon, she can get held down, and she is quite inactive off of her back. And that's something I've always worried about, especially as she's gotten older. But this is a weird fight against Carol Hossa, too, because this is what I'll give it off to you on. Carol Hosa, at least her last two fights, has been much better than her opponents. And even going into the Betch Kohea fight, Betch wasn't all in on that fight. It was a retirement fight. I vividly remember saying in the prediction video, like, I expect Hosa to win for no other reason than I just don't think Kohea is showing up to win. And Rosa won that, and she looked really good. But again, beating a Betch Kohea who had one foot out isn't proving to me that you are a top 15 deserving fighter. And here's sort of the cop-out. If she beats Sarah McMahon, maybe that won't prove it to me either, because McMahon is another one of these fighters who, on her best day, looks very good, and on her worst day, doesn't look great. So it sucks for Hosa, because it feels like no matter what the result of this fight is, at least for me, and just because I'm saying it doesn't mean I'm right, but I'm gonna need to see her fight at least one more fighter who I have more confidence in, who's at least considered in the prime of their career. That's something I would really like to see moving forward. But I do expect her to be able to get this win over Sarah McMahon, really due to her striking volume, because with McMahon, a very stiff striker, especially on the feet, and with Hosa, she can mix in the kick, she has great volume. But again, everything comes down to the wrestling offense of Sarah McMahon.
Yeah, I mean, if anything hinges on anything in this fight, it's what version of Sarah McMahon do exactly. We get? Because for Carol Hosa, you look at it, I love the level of competition outside of the UFC. A loss to Gisele Mojea, who you're going to see on a ton of records, not just in Brazil, but all over the place. You look at it, a loss to Larissa Pacheco. Well, again, she just fought with the PFL not that long ago in their headliner for the championship, and she had a lot of success over there. A loss to Melissa Gatto in the first round where...
Don't grapple with that lady.
Hosa's winning the first round, and then she's on top, and Gatto just kind of grabs it, ends up with a weird Kimura. But in the UFC, and again... Hosa is able to get the win back over a Mojea, finishes her, ends up in the UFC, beats Procopio by split decision. It's a wild fight. You got to go back. It's a lot of fun to watch. But again, like, you beat Vanessa Mello. I don't learn anything out of that one. You beat Betch Kohea. It's not that great. And, like, she looked good in that fight.
And the Jocelyn Edwards win is a good one, too. But again, Jocelyn's another fighter who we don't really know that much about right now. She's also going to need a lot more time to develop. So the wins that Hosa has, they're good wins. They just don't really tell us that much.
But the thing about Carol Hosa is she really mixes it up to all three levels. She can really work behind a nice jab. She can mix in her leg kicks. The one thing you worry about is... if you're going kick heavy against Sarah McMahon, you're going to get taken down. So for me, I look at this fight. I mean, Hosa has a giant advantage in terms of the age. She's 14 friggin' years younger. We don't say that very often in MMA. And you look at it, I mean, definitely the more active fighter. I know not that long ago there were bits of inactivity. But again, for Sarah McMahon, 5 years ago was her fifth to last fight. The last time she came out against Juliana Pena, who... is your champion. That was a year and a month ago. Before that, the win over Lena Landsberg 2 years ago. Lena is a primary striker, if I've ever seen one.
So the elbow queen.
We look at the odds for this one. McMahon open to plus 170, plus 182 right now. For Carol Hosa, open to plus 200, minus 228. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Hosa.
I'll say over.
They've been skewed this week. Yeah, 979. Holy smokes. 87% going with Hosa, 84% by decision for the 13% that are McMahon, 74% by decision. So not that surprising here. And I mean, for me, again, I really do like Carol Hosa. I like the defensive hips against most other fighters. Sarah McMahon's a different fighter. And again, she has had good takedown defense, has Hosa in the UFC. Edwards was able to get one, but I think she got like 2 seconds of control time. Like, again, Hosa was right back up again. So I don't really put too much stock into that one. It's just, what McMahon do we get? I do, though, expect Hosa to win out in this one.
So could the best version of Sarah McMahon beat Carol Hosa? Of course she could, without a doubt. But that'd be like waiting 4 years for LeBron James and then still expecting him to win MVP. He's 37 years old and people think he's ancient for his sport. Sarah McMahon's 41 in a sport where you take a lot of punishment in, where it kind of makes you age a lot faster due to the injuries and due to the damage that you take throughout your career. I just don't think we're going to see the best version of Sarah McMahon. And even if there is a small chance that we do see it, that chance is fairly small given her age and given her experience in the sport. Her losses, especially as of late, aren't bad whatsoever. But it's really hard to expect the best version of Sarah McMahon this weekend. And that's why I like Carol Hosa. I expect her to really shine through with her volume striking. But it will be interesting if this is really going to prove, wow, Carol Hosa, she might defend a few takedowns early and really build as the fight goes on. That'd be the type of performance that could get me on board. But I think this is going to be a very important fight for her career.
Speaking about on board, this could be the springboard to get Carol Hosa into the lexicon of Joe Rogan to say, wow, that girl, she's nasty. But a big time opportunity for both these women in the bantamweight division will be a career resurgence for Sarah McMahon, 2004 Olympic silver medalist.
She starts training in Connecticut with Glover. Teach me your ways.
And a big time opportunity for Carol Hosa as well. Both of us going with the Brazilian in this matchup. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Big time fights, especially in the women's flyweight division. You've got Jennifer Maia taking on Manon Fiorot. You also have in the co-main event, Joanne Wood taking on Alexa Grasso. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend at lightweight, the highs have been high for Vyacheslav Borshov. You know him as Slava Claus. And for Mark Jacasey, the highs have been highs, but also the lows have been incredibly low. And if you look at it for Jacasey in the UFC, he's riding a wave of momentum. Debuts at UFC 204, picks up a giant win over Lukasz Sajewski. Then he beats Frankie Perez. Then he beats Tamu Paklin in one of the most disgusting knockouts you're ever going to see.
It's beautiful, though.
And then he loses to Jakar Close, Dan Hooker, and Nasrat Haqparast. He takes some time off. He fights Joe Duffy. He beats him in impressive fashion. He beats Groovy Lando Venata. He takes a bunch more time off. He has a fight of the night against Fiziev. It was a decent one. Some people, most people, thought he lost 30-27, but he mixed it up.
It was a good fight, though.
And then he fights Rafael Alves his last time out, and it was close until it wasn't, because really, it ends very quickly. But Jacasey was starting to figure things out. And then all of a sudden, Alves runs across the cage, hits him, flying knee, and then when Jacasey goes, well, you know what? I'm not just a striker. I'm not just the guy that came in with the flashy spin kicks and the elbows at the start of my career. I'm going to go for a double leg takedown. Alves goes, no, that's cute. Guillotine, and finishes him very, very quickly. So if you do look at it for Jacasey, I mean, really.
Same thing happened to him against Dan Hooker.
We're 2-5 in the last 7 fights, but it really has been, again, highs are high, lows are low. Decent level of competition, we can really say that one. And when you're having fight of the nights against Fiziev, you must be doing something right. And for Borshov, you look at it, I mean, this is a guy that just decided, hey, like, we're going to just take a pilgrimage to Team Alpha Male. We're going to go across the pond and just go there to train and end up in the States on a P1 visa and working at the gym and just hanging out with the boys and really having a good time. And for Borshov, it really has worked out. I mean, the guy, again, you compare records. One's way better than the other. One's more experienced than the other. But if you look at it for Borshov, I mean, 2-0 in boxing in 2019. He has 18 wins in kickboxing out of 20 pro fights there. He is, and I want to make sure that I get this one right, a former K1 champ in 2010 and 2011. His kickboxing is so much damn fun to watch. Now, will he get caught sometimes and drop? Yeah,
maybe.
But against Kenley St. Louis, he comes back and he wins that fight. Does he get taken down in some of his fights? Yeah, he does. But mostly, he gets back up. I mean, he's 6-1 at this point. And in his UFC debut against Dakota Bush, 2 of 3 of those takedown attempts land. He was in some compromised positions. He gets right back up. My favorite shot. You want to see a great shot? When a guy sets up and just throws his right hand out there to the body to make Bush really go down and dirty to the one side and then follows it up, rips to the body with the left hook. My favorite shot in all of MMA and boxing, maybe even all of combat sports. Borshov, we learned in his last fight, I'm not ready to say he's the real deal, but he's like,
could be.
That movie with Hugh Jackman, he's real steel. Robots fighting, real steel. Wow, that happened.
I had a friend whose birthday party was to that movie, and it was not a very good movie.
I went for a date and saw that movie.
That tells us more about you than I think anybody wanted to know.
Well, again, like, I was in high school.
You want to watch some robot boxing, babe? Oh, no. Okay, for Slava Claus, he is an eye-catching talent. And both guys are. That's the weird thing I want to say about this fight. If you knew nothing about either guy coming into this fight, and you just showed, like, a new MMA fan, Slava Claus versus Mark Jacasey, it's probably going to be a sick fight. Like, I don't think this is going to be a boring fight by any stretch of the imagination, because Jacasey can grapple, but here's the problem. He leaves his neck out way too much every time he goes for takedowns, to where if you have any level of offensive submissions with your, I should say, any level of defensive submissions, because a lot of times it is them defending his takedown with the submissions, he gets submitted that way. He doesn't have great submission defense. That is something that worries me against the upper echelon grapplers. Now, of course, Slava Claus isn't this good at striking because he's also this good at grappling. There is a give and take to MMA, and it's very hard to specialize in everything. But this is going to be a weird fight, because I don't think Jacasey's going to go for a takedown, but I actually think mentally that's going to help him unlock a lot of his own striking, because with Jacasey, he is so good on the outside, and he's a lot faster, too. I do think that's going to be a big key to this fight. Does Slava Claus hit harder than Mark Jacasey? Without a doubt. Probably hits twice as hard as he does, but Jacasey's speed with his straight shots is very deceiving. This is the weird thing, though, and I guess I really want your opinion on this. With Chikadze, he went from fighting Nasrat Haqparast, a fight that was, at least going into it, it was okay, we have a couple prospects, they both had a loss, we'll see who's the better of the two. He got destroyed in that fight, didn't look good at all. Gets dropped multiple times, and Nasrat put a pace on him he just couldn't deal with. And then he turns around and looks as good as he ever does against Joe Duffy. Like, how do you gauge where Mark Chikadze is going to be on a fight? Now, I know that's a hard question to ask, but I guess what version of Chikadze do you think we'll see this weekend?
So the Fazeev fight, and again, I talked about it, periods of inactivity. So Chikadze debuts, and I want to make sure I get this one right, in 2016 back at UFC 204. That was Bisping versus Henderson 2, a wild fight. And then he fights another time in 2016. He fights three times in 2017, once in 2018, twice in 2019, once in 2020, once in 2021. That was back in November. So it's not that long ago. But I expected a lot out of him against Rafael Alves. And this is the craziest thing. I think this answers the question, Matt. Mark Chikadze's only been an underdog in one fight in UFC.
Isn't that wild?
Do you know which one it was?
It was the Fazeev one. No, Nasrat Haqparast.
Nope. So 10 fights in the UFC. He was only an underdog against Joe Duffy. And the majority of the time, he's floating around 2-1 as a favorite. So that tells you all you need to know about him. He was favored to beat Fazeev. So much, though, that if you go back through the Fight Night Picks anthology, I said he was going to beat Rafael Fazeev. Rafael Fazeev, because it was Rafael Dos Anjos, Rafael Fazeev. See? Sometimes you make mistakes, you got to make up for them. But he was also favored to beat Alves. And if you look at it in that
big
one...
Big favorite, wasn't he?
Roughly, yeah, minus 240. And again... In the first minute, he was looking pretty good. The first minute and a half, he was looking pretty good. And then all of a sudden, Alves did the old, you know what, I'm a wild man. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to get this finish. So, again, against Borshev, I do expect a little bit more of a patient approach from Chikadze. He trained before, and he's been all over the place, but mostly American top team. For this one, looks like it's Great Britain top team. But in Chikadze, even outside of the UFC, he was a Bama champ at lightweight. Whatever that means to you, it means to me, but... A 36-second win over Kane Moose is one of those ones that just ages like a fine wine. So, again, I look at this fight for Borshev, great leg kicks, great counters on the way into. Like, guys will get kind of lulled. And, again, he has that one against Bush where he goes, like, right hand to make him think and then throws the left hook. Against Chris Duncan, it's kind of the same thing, but it's up here, too. And he was beating the bejesus out of poor Chris Duncan, who... A lot of people might just think Chris Duncan, oh, it's a jobber on Dana White's Contender Series. Chris Duncan's a really good fighter out of Scotland, had some good experience with Bellator and the regional scene over in Europe. So I look at this one, the odds on it, Chikadze opened a plus 135. He's roughly a plus 150 right now. If you look at it for Slava Claus, open to minus 155. He is a minus 177 favorite right now. I'm going to say, Matt, over-under on Tapology. Surprise to us, they are to you. 70% Slava Claus.
Think they'll be under.
I think they're going to be under. Wow. They're over. 965 total votes for Borshev. 81% for him. 75% by knockout for the 19% that have Chikadze. 59% by decision. So, Matt, Borshev, he's 6-1 in MMA. He could be a generational talent at lightweight.
I don't know about
that. We could be unlocking these doors, and we don't know what's
behind.
Charles
Oliveira exists, so let's calm down.
This is like we're playing Resident Evil. Do we go with what could be behind door number three with...
Have you ever played Resident Evil?
Slava Borshev, I've watched people play Resident Evil. I've had, you know...
Because you're making it sound like, let's make a deal right now, and I can assure you it is not.
Let's make a deal, Slava Borshev. But when I look at this one, I love what both these guys bring to the table, and we wouldn't have this as such a fun fight if they weren't so damn good.
Exactly. But this is what I've got to say. If Mark Chikadze was the fighter I thought he was, he would beat Slava Borshev. I don't think he is that fighter, though, and that's why I have to pick Slava Claus. Mark Chikadze has been dropped a lot throughout his UFC career. He is a really good striker, but again, I go back to that Nasrat Haqparast fight. That was a bully beatdown against another primary striker who barely went for a takedown against him. Like, Nasrat truly did beat the brakes off Mark Chikadze. I highly recommend going back and watching that fight. He busts up his eye with a jab. He's way faster than him on his entries, and that's the thing. If you give Chikadze time to really set himself up, then he'll have a lot of success because of his speed and because of his reaction time. But if you expect him to just go in there and strike with a guy like Borishev, I don't think he's going to be able to do it. I really do think he's going to be eating a lot of damage early on in the fight, even though, and this is the last thing I'll say, Slava's the older guy in this matchup. Andrew Casey has had many more fights in the UFC, but the issue is he hasn't looked good in too many of them for me to pick him.
Slava Claus, I watched him not that long ago in the past calendar year take on 3-3 Kenley St. Louis, get dropped in the first round. And I'm not, like, I don't mean like a stumble and a wobble. His face hit the canvas, popped back up.
Ilya got head kicked by Jai Herbert, and we both had him to destroy him.
And then he came back and rallied in the second round and looked really good. I mean, Borshev gets hit quite a bit, and listen, he is a hell of a striker. You wouldn't be at this point if you weren't. Again, do I go with the bill of goods that I was sold on Gekasey all the way up? I do, because he's fought the way better level of competition.
But you've seen him give up, though, and that's something I worry about.
I see him lose to Nasrat Haqparast, come back out, drop Joe Duffy, and beat him quite soundly, and then get another win, have a fight against Fazeev, the top weight competitive in a fight of the night, not get dropped, and then against Alves, get rocked, get hit by a crazy flying knee, and then get submitted. Again, is it too much too soon for Gekasey? I know that might sound odd, but considering the fact that he just fought in November and got finished that way, I don't think it is, and I like the complete skill set of Gekasey in this one against Borshev, although again, Borshev is one of the most, you know, wild strikers we've seen here recently, with the finishing ability to go with it, too.
I agree with everything you said. Gekasey definitely is the more well-rounded guy. I just don't think we're going to see those layers of his game. I think he's going to choose to strike with Borshev, and I think that's a terrible idea for anybody to do in this division. Unless you're like a Brad Riddell or a Fazeev, then okay, those are great fights, and I'm really excited about the potential of those in the future, but I do have Borshev winning this one. This is a wild fight, though. Both guys could win by first-round knockout. Both guys could win by third-round knockout. This could be a great fight.
Big-time opportunity for both of these men at lightweight. Are you going with the underdog in Mark Gekasey? Are you going with Slava Borshev? It is a big-time opportunity for both of us as well, because we have a big-time card coming up, and you got Christakis trying to challenge the man who's always up there at the top, knocking on the door in Curtis Blaydes. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
With a combined experience of 37 UFC bouts split between these two guys, we have a big-time fight coming up at welterweight between the ranked Neil Magny, the unranked Max Griffin. And when you consider it, both of these guys were involved in the Ultimate Fighter season. Lesnar versus Carwin. Max Griffin wasn't even able to make it out of the qualifying rounds. Neil Magny made it all the way to the semi. So a big time opportunity for bragging rights there. I'm sure nobody's going to talk about that this week, but you heard it here first. And when you look at this one, Neil Magny's fought the way tougher level of competition. And I'm going to list some of the guys that he's fought. He's fought Kelvin Gastelum, Johnny Hendricks, Rafael Dos Anjos, Carlos Condit, and Robbie Lawler.
Damian Maia?
All guys and Damian Maia that are all title adjacent. So some pretty strong experience there for Neil Magny. Now, the spot where he's really struggled, main events. I mean, he's 1-2 in main event opportunities. They've all been outside of the United States. The first one was against Kelvin Gastelum. It was a fight of the night. It was a split decision win. That one in Mexico. He takes on Santiago Ponzinibbio in Argentina. He loses that one in impressive fashion. I guess impressive for Ponzinibbio. And then he takes on Michael Chiesa in a fight that you don't remember, and nobody does, because it was on a Wednesday.
Sadly, I do, and it was one of the worst main events I've ever seen.
It was on a Wednesday in Abu Dhabi. That was like, I've secured an island. We're going to Fight Island. But realistically, when you look at it for Neil Magny, by and large, very good defensive wrestling. We see that. I mean, Chiesa was able to expose it, but Chiesa is very good in that one respect. And very good, really good volume, and it lasts from the first round all the way to the third round. And if you go back and watch his last fight against Jeff Neal, Jeff Neal is one of those guys that's very, very cerebral, really picks the shots. It was to his detriment, especially in the third round when he was fighting Magny, because even Magny on the back foot, he's popping volume, he's pawing out the jab, he's throwing that right hand out there, he's throwing a leg out there. He's always doing something in those circumstances. And listen, we're to the point right now where Neil Magny is still ranked at 34, putting on performances like this, and it's really freaking tough to beat him.
You know country music a lot better than I do. Who's the guy who sings, "When it rains, it pours"?
You don't know who Luke Combs is?
I don't listen to a lot of country music. Neil Magny, that is his career. Like, when he's winning, he wins 7 fights in a row, and you're like, wow, Neil Magny's back. Because that's been the story of Magny's career. He'll go on a long win streak, get a big opportunity, similar to the one he got against Damian Maia, and that's always the first one I go back to. UFC 194, I don't know why my memory is so good about Neil Magny versus Damian Maia, but when Maia is having success, he takes him down, immediately takes his back, and there's not a lot of give and go. 190, sorry, I was off by a few. When Neil Magny's having success, though, like you had said, it's a lot of volume. It's just a lot at once. But when things are going poorly for Neil Magny, oh my god, they go poorly. And I bring up basketball a lot on this channel, and when you watch a lot of any sport, you just sort of focus on a team's weaknesses more than their strengths, you know, because coaches at the professional level are really, really smart, and that's what they focus on too. And if you guys know anything about the Philadelphia 76ers, you would know they've got some strengths right now. James Harden, Joel Embiid, that's good. A lot of weaknesses on that team, though, that people just don't want to talk about, and that feels like the game of Neil Magny, because if we just want to talk about the positives, I'd argue he's one of the best volume strikers in this division, one of the rangiest strikers in this division, and I know we'll have more to talk about this, probably at least an above-average wrestler. I would say one of the better overall grapplers in this division. But that's the thing about Neil Magny. He's not really a wrestler. He's not really a jiu-jitsu player. He uses a lot of clinch, and he uses that for his striking. He's really good with his elbows up close. It's just nothing Neil Magny does is really by the book. This is what I will say, though. When he is able to keep his range, he is a very, very tough fighter to fight. I always go back, and again, to the Kelvin Gastelum main event, because against Gastelum, he starts out very strong, but as the fight goes on, Gastelum's starting to close the distance, and he gets closer and closer and closer, to where he drops Magny twice in the later rounds of that fight. But, like I said, early in the fight, when Magny's having a lot of success with a lot of his volume, Gastelum can't get anything going, because when you're fighting someone like Magny, it's kind of like fighting Aljamain Sterling with way worse grappling. You have to worry a lot about the volume, you have to worry a lot defensively, and you can't really throw your own punches, because when you're fighting an opponent who's always doing something to you, you're the one reacting to what they're doing, and you're not the one imposing your will. So let's go to the flip side of Max Griffin. We brought up some of the weaknesses of Neil Magny. Magny, I don't think, is going to get out-wrestled by Max Griffin. I think Max Griffin hits a lot harder, especially with his boxing. But the thing I worry about with Griffin is that if he is going to have success on the feet, he really is only a boxer. And I think that's going to be really tough to do against someone like Magny, who can't implement his front kicks and leg kicks so well.
When you look at it for Max Griffin, I had no idea, and I've been doing this for a time or two, that he's a black belt in Bok Fu. Do you know what Bok Fu is, Matt?
No idea.
It's a combination of Kenpo, Karate, Taekwondo, and Kung Fu. I had no clue! And this has, like, been a known thing that's out there for a long time. But, again, you look at the win streak that Max Griffin's on, and it's completely resurrected his career. And I know he had lost two in a row, one to Alex Morono. That was a wild fight. Like, Griffin comes back near the end. Split decision loss to Alex Oliveira. He goes out there against Ramiz Brahimi and just, like, takes everything he ever worked for.
Ramiz is great, though.
And then he goes out there against Sung Kanon, and he looked like a man possessed, finishing him early, throwing the kicks, really putting everything together. And then his last time against Carlos Condit in the first round, it was like, okay, like, we're here. We're really doing this. So, again, in that fight, knocks him down. I mean, it was just work, work, work. He was totally outworking
like
him.
Rihanna.
Let Condit back in the second round. In the third round, he really took over. But really what I had there was, he actually had really good leg kicks in his last fight, which isn't something that we talk about a lot out of Max Griffin. And he was throwing them so damn hard that, like, Condit couldn't check them. Condit was, like, spinning on everyone. It really did.
Condit's retired 7 times before that fight.
It really did take him away. Condit was on a nice little run before that one. You simmer down.
Craig, he beat Court McGee. He wasn't on a nice little run.
And in that Morono fight, again, I bring that up because Max Griffin got dropped in the second round of that only to rally back. So, again, very, very tough fighter, very tricky fighter. Again, I know he's trained a little bit out of Team Alpha Male, a little bit out of MMA Gold, but primarily out of Mare Nobles martial arts and kickboxing. So when it comes to this fight, again, with Max Griffin, it's a lot of forward pressure, and he kind of can follow guys. He doesn't necessarily cut the cage all that well. For Neil Magny, we don't talk about this very often, but a fighter who's very good on the back foot at still throwing a lot of volume, still doing something.
But here's the problem, though. When he's on the back foot, that's when he's susceptible to getting hit by power shots. He was on the back foot against Ponce Dibio. He was on the back foot against Gastelum when he got caught. Like, that's when he is susceptible to those big shots.
Like most people. But when we look at the
odds
for this
one, it's
not
a strength for him, then, if it gets caught like most people.
25-9. Like, we're talking about a very good fighter who's only losing to the upper echelon getting knocked out.
I understand, though, but I wouldn't say striking on the back foot is a big strength of Magny. That's what I would watch out for if I think Griffin's going to have a lot of success. I think Magny needs to be the one walking forward, because when he is walking backwards, he is super susceptible to leg kicks and power shots. So I don't think Magny's that good of a striker moving backwards. I really do think he's going to need that forward pressure.
Beat the tar out of Jeff Neal in the third round of his last fight doing that. We look at the odds for this one. Neal Magny open -150. He's -220 right now. Max Griffin open at a +130. He's +180. If we have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us, they are to you. Matt, I'm going to say 65% over under Magny.
I would say over.
I'm going to say, oh my goodness. 979 total votes, 92% Magny, 86% by decision for the 8% that have Griffin, 52% by decision, 34% by knockout. I think Neil Magny's going to win a decision in this one. I know that might be, you know, a shocker to most people. But, yeah, you look at this one, Matt. Max Griffin's on a tidy little run. But I don't see him having the tools. And when he really does set up those power right hands, they're great. And he could do that against Magny. I just don't see it in this one.
So you brought up the Jeff Neal fight a lot, and I do think that's a good one to bring up. But I go back to the Li Jingliang fight, too, because what Neil Magny was able to do against Jingliang was, when we're all the way on the outside, I'm going to have a lot of volume, and the second you get close to me, I'm going to clinch you and throw elbows, and that's it. He never gave Jingliang the chance to get the fight in his Goldilocks zone to where it was his perfect range. And oddly enough, Max Griffin does have a similar perfect range to someone like Li Jingliang, where they can land the leg kick, where they can land some of those uppercuts. Neil Magny is made to fight some of those guys. Now, again, the upper echelon power punchers are always going to give Magny trouble, but against these other sort of well-rounded type of fighters, Magny's always going to have a lot of success, I believe. So unless Magny has completely fallen off, because he has been at the top of the division for a long time, I do like him in this fight, though.
Big time opportunity for both of these guys. Do you have sea level Max Griffin? Do you have mountain level Neil Magny, a majestic fighter out of Elevation Fight Team? Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight and in the rest of them. You guys drive the channel. We certainly appreciate that. Big time fight in the main event. You got Curtis Blaydes taking on Chris Daukaus. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Manon Fiorot is one of the biggest rising stars in the women's flyweight division since it was introduced in 2017. She's going to be taking on the former Invicta champion who was able to get a round. She won a round against the champion.
Oh, I'm going to talk about it.
Valentina Shevchenko. We're talking about Jennifer Maia. And this one, I'm going to throw it up there on screen from Jennifer Maia's Instagram. She announced that she had signed the contract 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, so it is short notice that way now. For Manon Fiorot, she was supposed to take on Jessica Ai at UFC 272. I had gone back to Believe Land. We were training out a strong style, and unfortunately that fight could not happen. Now, did we do the graphics for it?
We did.
Did we almost do the video for it? Yes, we did. However, it was kind of scratched on such short notice. So this fight is thrown together, and for Fiorot, you look at it, and I mean, listen, you could already tell how talented she was outside of the UFC. Her first fight was a loss, a very, very close fight against Leah McCourt.
A very recognizable name.
A very recognizable name that lost to Sinead Kavanagh last time out. But if you look at it, she competes with UAE Warriors and just continues to rock off the wins. And whenever Canada's cut in, La Framboise, who I just saw had a fight announced, that's always exciting. Somebody that she actually trained with getting ready for her last fight, and I saw that one, was cut in La Framboise, because for her, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, Fiorot actually played on the ground a little bit and won out in some of those exchanges. I think that is important. Although, if you look at La Framboise and her career, maybe not the highest of highs, but when you consider everything, it is important. But when you look at Manon, again, I've called her the Maria Sharapova of MMA striking, because it's a lot of when she's throwing those kicks. But front kicks, side kick to the body. Like, we know what Manon Fiorot is going to bring. And the level of competition in the debut, Victoria Leonardo, maybe not the best, but a recognizable name. Tabitha Ricci is not a flyweight, and that fight never should have happened, but Manon looked very good. And then her last time out against Maeda Buena Silva, that's where we finally get to learn a little bit, because Maeda Buena Silva, very good boxer, very good at closing distance. Judges scored the contest 30-27, 30-27, 30-26. Manon was able to go out there and get takedowns, a lot of control time in that fight, complete performance from the beast in that one, and a little bit of a progression, a little bit of an opportunity for UFC fans to learn more about Fiorot. But when it comes back to it, Matt, again, she's 32, it's like John Cena, my time is now. And she is one of the more dynamic and impressive strikers in this division right now.
Without a doubt. And she's a genuine power threat at this division, in a division where not many women are. You've got Jessica Andrade, who can get knockouts.
Molly McCann,
who has the best elbows in the UFC. Funny story about that, I might as well tell it. A bunch of my friends were at an Xbox party, and I went to go get some food. I came back, the fights were on, I rarely do that. But I come back, and I put my headset on, and my friends were like, you're not going to believe it. Like, Molly McCann won via spinning elbow. And I'm like, you guys are terrible at lying. Like, be honest, pull out Twitter. I was wrong. I should have believed them. Wild outcome. This is a very weird fight, though, because it's going to be all one-way traffic, one way or the other. Either Manal keeps this fight on the feet and absolutely brutalizes Jennifer Maia, because as you were talking about the improvements in Manal's grappling, I agree. But it's very similar to when Jamal Hill was like, I know I'm fighting Paul Craig, but you've never seen me on the mats. It's like, okay, we get it. You've been improving, but let's not count our chickens before they've hatched. You still need a long ways to go before you get to the level of, like, a natural, talented, just a pure grappler. So with Piojo, do I think she could hang for a couple moments on the ground with Maia? I do. I think she's very physically strong for this weight division, and I think that's the thing that really does help her, because she's so strong, especially in the guard. She can use one hand to punch and kind of get damage off, and it's really hard to be, you know, playing around, trying to get arm bars when you're constantly being hit in the head. There's that very old quote where it's, what happens when you hit a black belt in the head one time? They become a purple belt. Or they become a brown belt, then a purple belt, and it just keeps on going down. Because in jiu-jitsu, you don't have to worry about shots to the head like you do in MMA. And for a lot of jiu-jitsu practitioners, that kind of is the thing that really kind of unwinds them in the cage. They start getting hit a few times. I know Gary Tonin didn't have a great fight his last time out, but even look at that. He was playing around on the ground a little bit too much, felt a little bit overconfident, and paid the ultimate price for it. I don't think Jennifer Maia is going to get knocked out from her guard because she's playing around trying to get an ankle lock.
Jennifer Maia, leg locker.
But this is the thing that I do keep on going back to. Manal cannot grapple with Jennifer Maia for even a minute in this fight. She can, but I just think stylistically and game plan wise, it's one of the worst decisions she could have, because Maia offers little to no threat on the feet. Oddly enough, she has a good body kick from that left stance. She is someone who, yeah, has a very upright style, but not in a way that like a Vicente Luque does. Like, Luque holds his hands high. He's got a traditional Thai style, but that's all serving a purpose. All of that movement is to try to set up his own strikes, try to delay your timing, and help him defensively. Whereas with Maia, it's a lot of the Muay Thai movements, but not a lot of the output behind it. And that's why I think she's really going to struggle on the feet. But again, even if Fiolo drops Maia, don't jump into her guard. Just let her get up. Because Maya's one of these few grapplers who, when she's on top, yeah, she's dangerous. But even from her full guard, she can throw up arm bars, triangle chokes. You're definitely not out of the hot water once you get on top.
We haven't really seen it in the UFC. That's the craziest part. So for Maia, she is 10 wins by decision. She has 9 of them by finish, but 7 of 8 of her overall fights in the UFC have gone to decision. The Wood submission is the only one that she has, and that was to get into the title fight against Valentina Shevchenko. And again, she was able to win a round. That's great, but what she looked like after that? Well, she fights Jessica Ai, 29-28, 29-28, 30-27 on MMA decisions. 2 of them had it 30-27 for Jennifer Maia. 6 of them had it 29-28 for Maia. 9 of them had it 29-28 for Jessica Ai.
I thought Maia won.
She had a close fight against Jessica Ai. So then her last time out, she takes on Caitlin Chookagian in the rematch that everybody wanted and lost all 3 rounds. All 3 judges, 30-27. Maia just chased around the cage and got totally out-volumed to the surprise of nobody. So again, she's taking this fight on 2 weeks' notice. You can say the same thing for Fiodo, I guess. She was getting ready for Jessica Ai not that long ago. Again, that was UFC 272. Now she gets Jennifer Maia. Ai, probably not a threat with her grappling. And
that would have been a tough fight for Jessica Ai against Manal.
Really tough fight. And for Jennifer Maia, again, it's that high tie stance. She might throw some kicks. She will work in some of her boxing. She does throw nicely in combination. But Matt, when I look at the odds for this one, like, again, I didn't know what the damn odds were as I was doing my notes. Like, there's no bias that way. And then just before we go live, I go on Best Fight Odds, I rate them down, and then we talk about them. I had no clue that Maia opened a plus 190. She's now plus 330, we'll call it. Fiodo opened a minus 225. Minus 432. People really like Manal Fiodo in this one. The topology votes, surprise to us, they are to you. No, they're not. 970 total votes, 87% Fiodo, 70% by decision, 22% by knockout, 13% that Maia, 71% by decision. So all of a sudden, a year, 3 months ago, Jennifer Maia is going from a title fight to fighting Manal Fiodo, and she's a giant underdog.
If Valentina Shevchenko is Kevin Durant of this division, Manal Fiodo is like Brandon Ingram. Like, if you squint a little bit, it sort of looks the same. They're both tall, they're thin, they shoot. They've got some similarities, but they just start to really break it down, and she does lack sort of the intangibles that someone like Valentina has, to where
she's
a great offensive grappler, a great defensive grappler. But honestly, strike for strike, Fiodo does strike in a very similar manner to Valentina. The big difference, though, is Valentina's a little bit lighter on her feet. She's not as much of a knockout puncher as Manal is. I know that might be a weird thing to say because Shevchenko does get more finishes, but a lot of her finishes come from ground and pound, come from submissions. She has a lot more different wrinkles to her game, whereas Manon primarily comes from the hands. I think Fiorot at range is going to have a ton of success in this fight against Maya. And the thing about Maya is that, yes, she has great jiu-jitsu. She has okay stand-up. She lacks the transition of the wrestling in between the two. So I do think that if Maya's having trouble on the feet, it's not like she can just decide, okay, now on my terms, we're taking this to the mat, like Curtis Blaydes will have in the main event. I know we'll get to that in a little bit. But in this fight, if she's getting beat up on the feet, unless she throws a Hail Mary shot and drops Fiorot, I don't think she can be able to get it to the mat, and that's why I like Manon.
Maya is not as volume heavy as of a striker as Fiorot. Maya doesn't have the downrange weapons up the middle. Fiorot, that's her bread and butter. Jennifer Maya likes to go for like a high crotch single leg. Manon Fiorot is the bigger fighter, and from what I've seen, she looks like the stronger fighter. So
single legs work against bigger people, though.
For me, I look at it as a win for Manon Fiorot. Do I like her at minus 433 or what have you? I'm not throwing it on my card. And I mean, again, I bet fight to go with a decision is probably like a minus 500, minus 600. So maybe you feel confident in that one. Maybe you want to throw that one down on your parlay. I'm just staying away from it. Pot and popcorn. Haven't picked against Frances Fiorot in any of her matchups so far in the UFC. I'm not going to do so this weekend either. Both of us going with Frances Fiorot here.
Yeah, if Maya Buena Silva was the appetizer to Fiorot's sort of conquest amongst the top 15, Jennifer Maya is going to be the main course. We're going to learn a lot about Manon. Because again, Maya Buena Silva is a good fighter, but Jennifer Maya fought for a title. And although she is only 2-3 in her last five, they've been against nothing but top levels of competition. So we're going to learn a lot about Fiorot this weekend. And if she is able to get the win, I'd expect probably like a title eliminator next, just because that's how wide open the division is. Her and Andrade.
Ceci devrait le co-main event to set fence some end. I mean, really, when you look at it, no, your co-main event, Joanne Wood taking on Alexa Grasso. But this one, more deserving in the scheme of the flyweight division, but I can't wait for it. Nonetheless, both of us going, like I said, with Fiorot in this matchup. Let us know down below if you have the former title challenger, the fighter that won a round against your champ, if you got Jennifer Maya or France's own, niece France's own, Manon Fiorot, big time fight card coming up that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Real barn burner of a fight coming up this weekend. The fans wanted it. You get it. This is the pinnacle of heavyweight MMA, especially unranked heavyweight MMA. I mean, really, if you consider this in the lineage of combat sports at heavyweight, Ali Frazier, 1971. You had Shane Carwin against Brock Lesnar in a battle of behemoths. Coming up this weekend, 44-year-old Alexei Olenek is looking for his 60th pro win. He's taking on a transplanted light heavyweight, the sledgehammer Aleer Latifi, a man who loves to ride horses with no shirt on. He is 38 years old. Matt, I hate this fight. It's ridiculous.
You know how kids are always like, my dad could beat up your dad? You know what the Fighters Hotel? Probably Aleer Latifi's kid and Alexei Olenek's kid are like, my dad could beat up your dad. Little do they know they're actually fighting and are the ages of fathers. This is a very strange fight because Aleer Latifi does not belong in this division. And it is very, very clear the second he fights at heavyweight just how much smaller he has been to everybody he's fought frame-wise.
Hold the phone now. We go back to Aleer Latifi's pro debut. He was cutting the mustard against Blagoy Ivanov. He goes for a takedown, pushes Blagoy back up against the ropes, and then the ropes collapse. It was like professional wrestling. So that's his no contest on his record. He was going to try and take down a guy who beat Fedor Emelianenko in Sambo.
It's not talked about enough how Aleer Latifi's first professional fight is a no contest against Blagoy Ivanov because it ended due to ring failure.
So we want the weirdness. Alexei Olenek back in 2013 submitted Mirko Krokop. He also has
the UFC.
12 Ezekiel choke submission wins. 12 of them. Like, do you know how hard it is to get an Ezekiel choke? I don't, because I don't do jiu-jitsu, but I watch a damn ton of it, and it's not the easiest submission.
Nobody only do it in a gi.
Alexei loves to go for it. He'll pull guard on it. He'll get, you know, the big baby. Like, he can really do it. Junior Albini, but 12 of them on his record. It's insane. But you look at it. I mean, the recent run for both these guys, not the sexiest. For Latifi, 4 years ago, a win over Vince St. Preux, lost to Beast in 25-8, lost to Volkan Oezdemir, lost to Derek Lewis, a win over Tanner Bowser by split decision. He definitely won that fight. We can all agree on that one.
Not the best fight ever.
And if you look at it for Alexei Olenek, remember, there was a time when he fought Alistair Overeem, when Alexei Olenek, though he was over 40, was a highly ranked opponent and on his roll. But you look at it, beats Maurice Greene by armbar, beats Fabrizio Verdum in one of the worst fights I've ever seen with these two eyeballs. He then loses to Derek Lewis by knockout. Had a lot of success in the first round, but that's all she wrote. Loses to Chris Daukaus, he looked bad. And then loses to Sergey Spivak by decision. And I know, Sergey Spivak's on his mythical run right now. But in that fight, Alexei Olenek looked like he was bearing the brunt of all, what, at the time, like 43 years of his existence. He looked bad in that fight against Sergey Spivak.
Father Time's undefeated. I hate to break it to people, but at a certain point, no matter how good you were in your prime is going to end. And with Alexei Olenek and with a lot of heavyweights, you can sort of continue your prime into at least your late 30s, sometimes early 40s like Olenek was able to do. But at 44, almost 45 years of age, like, Alexei Olenek is almost twice as old as I am. Like, when I was born, he was my age.
Oh, well, just a second. His first pro fight was in 1996, before you were born.
Exactly. I was born at the tail end of 1998. That just tells you how long Alexei Olenek's been doing the damn thing. He's been fighting MMA longer than I've been doing things. I've been doing things for a while now. So it really is just wild. Like, whenever we go back and make these graphics and you say, like, oh, when they made their MMA debut, guys like Alexei Olenek just leave me scratching my head. Like, it's wild that he has been able to stay so competitive this late into his career. But like you said, if you look at his last three fights, against Lewis, he has success early on. He looks good in the grappling. But let's be honest, if you're going to have any success against Derek Lewis, you're probably going to do it in the grappling department. And the second Olenek couldn't get that submission and his arms did burn out a little bit, it's not that he has bad cardio. Honestly, for a 44-year-old, he's probably got pretty good cardio. But it's not really like world-class athlete cardio at this point. He has that good first burst. But right now, Olenek reminds me of the stage that Joe Lauzon was at near the end of his sort of run. And I know Lauzon's fighting Cowboy here soon, but let's be honest, that's a sad fight for both guys compared to where they were in their primes. With Aliyah Latifi, though, this one I keep on going back to. Alexei Olenek, a good striker, definitely an improved striker. He dropped Travis Brown. He was able to box up Fabricio Werdum quite a bit, but against the top-tier power punchers, he does struggle. Not a great wrestler. He's got wonky takedown attempts and one of the best grapplers we've ever seen once the fight does hit the mat. Aliyah Latifi is nothing but a torso with knees. He's so hard to take down in any division that I find it very hard to believe that Alexei Olenek is going to be able to have sustained grappling success against Aliyah Latifi, because the way I look at it is, if Olenek can get him down early, he's only got like a minute and a half burst until his arms burn out, and then we do just sort of see that lumbering guy who stands on the outside.
Hold the phone here. So the one thing that I want to see out of this fight, because we poked fun, we've made our jibber jabbers. I look at it for Alexei Olenek. I want to see a second round. You know why?
Why?
Because I f***ing love it when Alexei Olenek lays his back on the canvas, they lift his legs up, they get the blood from his feet back up to his heart, and it's second round Olenek time. And I look at this one, the biggest thing that surprised me out of doing the deep dive on these guys, if I had to guess how many followers, and it means nothing to the game of MMA, Alexei Olenek had on Instagram, it wouldn't have been a million. It wouldn't have been a million. He has a million Instagram followers. He takes, like, glamour shots.
Listen,
over
you
there.
You beat Mirko Krokop, the world is yours.
Apparently it is. I mean, Nas probably knows who he is. The craziest part about it for Aliyah Latifi, he's been training at the UFC PI on Instagram 2 weeks ago. He's got a picture with Denis Tallulin, who's on this card, who might win, but probably not. Magomed Ankalaev and Beeston 25-8, former opponents. So you like to see that one. I'm surprised Beeston 25-8 goes to the PI, but when they call, he answers and he ends up there, probably there for Carl Robertson that we saw recently. The other thing about it too, when I look at it for Latifi, 7 weeks ago, he's at the PI with Tim Johnson. Then before that, he's over at Extreme Couture. I'm going to throw the picture up there because he's there hitting the mitts, and then he's also there boxing around with Francis Ngannou. The other part about it, he shows up to practice wearing a Knicks jersey, a Carmelo Anthony Knicks jersey.
That's like fire.
Aliyah, what are you doing? Like, he is...
You don't like mid-post ISO scoring in the mid-2010s and late 2000s?
You know I do. I mean, Melo, I'm a big Melo guy, but it was the weird... Like, it's like, again, it's like that guy in gym class that wants to impress. Here's Aliyah wearing his Knicks Carmelo Anthony jersey. So, I do like it. I like the quality of training partner. We know that he trained or has trained primarily at All-Stars. He's also spent some time training in around the Miami area, hence the horseback at sunset on the beach.
He looks better doing it than I would.
But when it comes down to this matchup, Matt, I threw my notes because this one just throws me for a loop. You have Latifi opening a minus 150, minus 175. You have Olenek at a plus 130, now a plus 150. I know a lot of people are going to say Olenek as an underdog, probably a good shot. So let's throw it on over to the Tapology vote. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Latifi.
I'll say under.
going to say under. Yeah, look at that. 990 total votes, 58% Latifi, 42% by decision, 49% by knockout. For the 42% that have Olenek, 79% by submission. Matt, it's hard to get a neck when you can't get it.
It really is. And again, that's what this fight keeps on going down to. On the feet, can Olenek have success? I think to a certain degree he can. He dropped Travis Brown, Craig. He boxed that. Like, no, he can have success in the feet. He even did well against Mirko Krokop before he took it to the ground. He's going to be able to box with Ali Latifi for a small period of time. The issue, though, is Ali Latifi throws overhands like those arm-flailing tube men you see outside of a used car dealership. He throws these odd, like, double hooks at the same time. Go back and watch the Corey Anderson fight. He has, like, a weird amount of success early on with them. But as the pace of the fight starts to wear on Latifi, that's when Anderson is able to pull apart. But that's the problem. Guys with really good cardio and guys who do specialize in their striking really give Ali Latifi issues. Well, Alexei Olenek definitely isn't a cardio king, and I don't look at him as one of the best strikers in this division. I don't think this is going to be a great fight by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think either one of us even thought about this when we were talking about Fight of the Nights before.
Pause for a second, because Alexei Olenek was supposed to take on Greg Hardy not that long ago. That fight fell out, and Ali Latifi last month was supposed to take on my guy, Alexander Romanov, and those fights fell through. Greg Hardy's not in the UFC anymore, but Alexei Olenek might have been a winnable fight for Greg Hardy, and you don't say that very often. But and Romanov would have beaten Ali Latifi quite soundly. Now we end up with
just
this fight.
Him so out of the cage.
It is a tricky hodgepodge of a fight if I've ever seen one.
I got Ali Latifi, though. I think the Sledgehammer can beat the Boa Constrictor. Decent nicknames, I'd say. I'd say this is a good nickname matchup. I do have Latifi, though. A, he's the bigger fighter at heavyweight, which isn't something that a lot of people have talked about this week. I guess this is early in the week, but it's just not really been a big talking point. Olenek has always been very close to light heavyweight. He's built sort of like a Chris Daugus, and we'll talk about that more in the main event, but I guess he's built more like Fedor Emelianenko, really. Like, Fedor is one of the best heavyweights ever. Probably is the best heavyweight ever. Not a big heavyweight by any means,
though. Way faster.
Exactly. And that really has been his big point, though, is Fedor would rather be the smaller guy because he can make up for it in speed. With Olenek, he does represent a smaller version of a heavyweight, whereas Ali Latifi, even though he fought at 205, will probably be the bigger fighter, at least thickness-wise. I think Latifi's going to win mainly due to his wrestling defense, and I do think he's the heavier-handed guy on the feet, but I don't think we're going to get a finish at either guy.
Never forget the time that Alexei Olenek fought Chael Sonnen in a Bodog fight at middleweight. That's
outdoors.
A thing that really happened. A big-time fight coming up this weekend. Both of us going with Sweden's Ali Latifi to get the win. You let us know for crazy down below. Do you like the underdog shot of Alexei Olenek to get his 60th pro win at age 44? Big time fights coming up on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Absolute f***ing banger coming up this weekend. You know we're fired up for it at Fight Night Picks, but this is a couple of guys that have some road miles on them, a couple of guys that get down to bang. And when you look at this one, for Matt Brown, is he a man? Is he 41 at this point in time? Yes, he is. But somehow, he went from being a guy that was 7-5 going into the Ultimate Fighter, a season that Amir Sadala ended up winning, to the guy that's here before you. He went on that crazy, crazy win streak that led him to a fight against Robbie Lawler. He was unsuccessful in that
fight, though.
But Matt Brown is one of those guys that you can never, ever count him out. And even at this point of his career, with Immortal Martial Arts, he's been training a lot of fighters that you know and love that are in the UFC. See, for him, he somehow ceremoniously retired Diego Lima. I know Lima was booked in a fight this spring, but he chose to retire. So you can go out and say, hey, I retired Douglas Lima's brother. And for Brown, he really didn't look all that great in that fight until he really did. It was in tight. He cocked his right hand like a schoolyard bully and just threw it right down the pipe and face planted Diego Lima. It was amazing. Now, these two guys, Brown and Barbarena, they were supposed to face off not that long ago. It was a number of months ago. Brown falls out of the fight and Barbarena decides, you know what? I'm here to fight. Give me Darian Weeks. So he goes in there, and listen, Weeks is a guy that...
really fun fight.
He's got a fight coming up against Ian Garry that I'm really excited about. But realistically, Weeks is really, really well-rounded. Good wrestling, good striking. I thought, hey, Weeks has good wrestling. Barbarena, questionable wrestling and takedown defense, though he does train at Gym O. But watching that fight, Brian Barbarena really did look a lot better than he did in some previous fights. In the Jason Witt fight, where he just... I know it was a majority decision win for Witt, and when it was in the striking, Barbarena had success, but his grappling did not look all that great. So when it comes to this fight, Matt, before I hand it off to you, I got ready for this one when I wasn't watching tape study, and I'll be completely honest with you. I was listening to Canadian Railroad Trilogy by Gordon Lightfoot, and then I listened to some Grand Funk Railroad. But when it comes down to this one, I expect some, you know, like seasoned, grizzled guys in their 40s to down a couple Budweisers, listen to Like a Rock by Bob Seger, and go out there and want to punch a punching bag in their garage.
Without a doubt, this is an all bar fight type of a fight in the UFC, and it's really weird. Brian Barberena is only 32 years old. I guess he's close to 33, but still not an old guy in his career at all. But it feels like he's much older than just what his age is, because he's had a lot of injuries throughout his career. And I do look at him kind of like Kemba Walker, to where Kemba's not an old guy either, but you just have the wrong injury at the wrong time, and it can really, really add up over time. And the thing about Matt Brown is he had an ACL reconstruction late in life too, but it didn't really seem to slow him down all that much. I know we'll like harp on some people for getting ACL surgeries and not other people. Let's just be honest. No one really knows if it's going to work or not. Nowadays, science is very good and doctors are very good. So for the majority of the time, when you get like Tommy John surgery or an ACL surgery, if you do just sit off to the side and rehab, you're more than likely going to be okay. But we're never sure though. And with Matt Brown, he was able to come back after that Diego Sanchez fight, and he has looked okay ever since. It's been really weird. You go back to the Miguel Baeza fight, gets off to a great start, and my buddy Tim likes to bring up this fight all the time because, to my credit, gonna be able to pat myself on the back, I said, Matt Brown's gonna hurt Miguel Baeza and get knocked unconscious. What happened in that fight, Craig? Matt Brown hurt Miguel Baeza and get knocked unconscious. That really has been the story of him in this last little run, to where he is willing to eat a punch to land a punch, but at 41 years old, when you've had a lot of fight of the nights, you've had a lot of these blood and gut type of fights, you don't have the same level of durability that you did back when you were fighting Robbie Lawler in main events of UFC fight nights. We're just definitely not going to see the best version of Matt Brown, and that's something I can guarantee you. With Barberena, and I'm really glad you brought this up based on his last fight, it looked like he was starting to trend downwards with a lot of these injuries, and with just, let's be honest, like the road wear on Brian Barberena. He's taken a lot of damage in some of these fights. But in his last fight, it did give you at least a little bit of confidence that he is getting back to his old form. I was bringing up Thiago Santos, to where right after the ACL surgeries, he looked awful. And he has looked a little bit better ever since. I know he lost to Ankalaev, but let's be honest, it's not like he got destroyed by Ankalaev. He made that a fairly competitive fight. With Barberena, I do feel like we are getting back to the borderline top 15 guy, but that's my problem. Do you even think Prime Barberena could beat Matt Brown, or is this just going to be one of those 50-50 fights no matter what stage of either guy's career they'd be in?
Prime guy, wild fight.
Matt Brown probably beats him prime.
Off-prime guy, still a wild fight. And the craziest part about it, for Brian Barberena, you got to consider, like, the Ellenberger brothers. They probably sit at home, and, like, he's in that, like, Pedro Siriaco Yankee killer mode where, well, I beat one, and then I beat the other one, and I finished both of them, and I knocked them both out. So for Barberena, the craziest part about it is, when I look at all of the body of work, did he finish Sage Northcutt?
He did.
That did happen. 7-6 in the UFC. His losses, just a few of the six. I've got four of them. Colby Covington, Leon Edwards, Vicente Luque, Rude Boy Randy Brown.
Those are all very good fighters.
Those are all really good fighters. And then again, like from 2020 to now, he's fought Anthony Ivey, Jason Witt, and Darian Weeks. Compare that to 2019 when he fought Luque and Brown. Like, we're not even talking about the same thing. And listen, he rallied in the third round against Jason Witt. He rallied against Weeks. He had a great third round. Barberena has had the sticking power in his last couple of fights. But again, Anthony Ivey didn't have a good run in the UFC. I was looking forward to more, actually. Like, I actually liked the tape study that I did on Ivey coming in. And Darian Weeks, I think, I don't know how long he's going to be around in the UFC, but I really do like his style. I like what I saw outside of it. And Jason Witt, Jason Witt's going to wrestle you, and if he doesn't wrestle you, he might get finished.
The thing that is concerning, though, is that Witt did have success on the feet against Barberena, which is not something I thought he would be able to at all. Going into that fight, of course you figured Witt would be able to take him down and have success if he was able to get it down, but Barberena did seem a little bit hesitant on the feet in that fight, and that's what does make me sort of... I'm not picking Matt Brown. I'm still trying to figure it out as we're shooting this video. But with Matt Brown, no matter what, he's going to be aggressive, and he's going to land a big shot. I just don't know if Brian Barberena can eat those shots consistently at this stage of his career. And I know he came back against Witt, but I do think Matt Brown hits a considerable amount harder than Jason Witt. But here's the thing. You brought it up. Brian Barberena, not a great wrestler. I think he's a whole hell of a lot better of a grappler than Matt Brown is at this stage of his career. Matt Brown got out-grappled by Carlos Condit, and that's something that pains me to say, but it was something that happened, so I have to say it. I think if Barbarina decides to grapple, it's by far his easiest path to victory.
So listen to Face the Pain, listen to a little bit of Korn, don't listen to Gordon Lightfoot and, you know, Grand Funk Railroad like I did getting ready for this one. But it comes to the odds, Matt Brown opened a minus 150 favorite. He's at par now, so that means Barbarina opened a plus 130. We have a look over on Tapology. The votes are a surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Bam Bam.
I would say over.
And no, 1,001 total votes, 72% Brown, 23% by decision, 69% by knockout for the 28% that are Barbarina, 55% by decision, 35% by knockout. Matt, when it comes to this fight, if you look at the way that Matt Brown fought Diego Lima, Lima's doing a great job moving on the outside, which we don't always talk about, but fighting behind the jab, going 1-2, landing really nice leg kicks that were really starting to compromise Brown from either side. This was Lima. Brian Barbarina has a great arsenal of kicks. It just depends on when he throws them. When he fights wrestlers, he doesn't throw them. It makes a lot of sense. When he fights some strikers, he doesn't throw them. That's a little bit puzzling. When he fought Jason Witt, that was coming off of like some really bad injuries, like life-threatening injuries. So it was a little bit, I got to turn everything up. And I attribute it to, again, you're getting your timing back, plus you're fighting a wrestler. But when I look at this one, again, Matt Brown for 41 still hits hard as a truck. And at the same time, Matt Brown doesn't throw a ton of volume. When he does, he makes it count.
Exactly.
But Matt Brown, my favorite shot that he throws, you don't see this very often.
Elbows.
Lead leg kick to the body, and it cracks, and it throws to great effect. But again, elbows are great.
He's the best elbow fighter in the UFC.
I love his front body kick, his lead leg body kick from the orthodox stance. It's one of my favorite things to watch him throw. But again, great right hand from a lot of different angles, too.
And I love Matt, again, like I don't cheer for any fighter in the UFC because we're way too attached to the sport. Like, just watching fights all the time, I don't care about what people do outside of the cage, none of that. I like Matt Brown, though. I can't even pick him to win this fight, because here's the thing. He's not a great grappler at this stage of his career, and he wasn't in his prime either, but when he did have his run into the top 15, and really into the top 5, he was able to just be effective enough with his stand-up to where I'm so aggressive and I'm so heavy-handed that I never really give a wrestler the chance to throw back at me. And then you started to figure out, though, that his durability was getting chipped away at. Go back to the Jake Ellenberger fight. Jake Ellenberger was way past his prime, and that was supposed to be a build-up fight for Matt Brown, coming off of a loss to Damian Maia in Brazil at UFC 198, I believe. No, that's exactly right. But what Matt Brown found himself in, he got wheel-kicked to the body by Jake Ellenberger and got finished early in that fight. Then his next time out has a great back-and-forth performance against Cowboy Cerrone, but we all remember how that fight ends, by one of the greatest head-kick knockouts of all time that Cowboy landed on Matt Brown. My issue is, I think Brown can have success. I just don't think it's going to be sustainable against Brian Barbarina, who, yes, I worry about some of his injuries, especially throughout his recent history, but the baseline version of Brian Barbarina is he's extremely well-rounded. Yes, he has a few weaknesses, you're right. His wrestling defense isn't great, but I'd still say overall, he's at least a decent grappler to where Matt Brown will be able to have a lot of success on the mat with him. So I think this is sort of a reassessment fight, if you will, for Brian Barbarina, but this is one that can get him right back on the winning track.
Big time opportunity for both guys. Again, for Barbarina, if he gets backed up, what's he going to do? Because you know Matt Brown is going to try and push that pace against you, but I like the complete arsenal, like I said, of Brian Barbarina. I like the volume out of him too, historically, and I got to go with the 32-year-old in this fight. So both of us going with the man himself at a gym. Oh, it's Brian Barbarina, but this should be a classic fight that you could find in a parking lot on a weekend somewhere near
you. I'm so excited.
I absolutely love it. Let us know down below what you're thinking of this matchup. We have Askarov versus Kai Kara-France. We have Grasso versus Wood. And in your main event, Curtis Blaydes taking on Chris Daukaus. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
With Brandon Moreno switching things up and going over to Glory MMA and Fitness and a rematch with Figgy Smalls and Mexico's own, in a bit of doubt, we have a big time fight coming up this weekend for a couple of guys looking to plant their flag atop the hill that is the next title shot at flyweight. It is Bullet Askar Askarov, the undefeated man who has a draw against the now former champion Brandon Moreno in his UFC debut, taking on Don't Blink Kai Kara France, who just picked up a big time first round knockout win over Cody Garbrandt his last time out. Matt, after Kai Kara France won that fight, which was not that long ago, we go back and it was what, 2 months and a week ago, you look at it and talking to Joe Rogan, these were his exact words. I told you I was going to answer a lot of questions tonight, and that's what I did. I know I'm the best in the world, and taking out a former champion makes me, well, it just puts me right in line for the next title shot. And guess what? Didn't mean a damn thing. And for Askar Askarov, his last time out, he fought a guy coming off of two title shots, and he got absolutely beaten senseless in both of them. And Joseph Benavidez, and what did Askar Askarov do? I know it's by decision. He beat him very soundly, and he looked improved on the feet. So for Askarov, you would have thought, okay, a win the way he was able to do it against Benavidez, maybe you get a title shot. Up this high, undefeated, a lot of hype, incredible grappler, and we'll get to that. But then he gets booked in a fight against Alex Perez in the summer, and Askarov's injured, so he's out of the fight, and Perez does the dance of, I'm going to fight Matt Schnell, and then I'm going to fight Matt Schnell again. For Askarov, a long time off, now he gets Kai Kara France. The other thing, too, that I'm sure hindered a title opportunity, you can see it on screen, Askarov missed weight for the fight against Benavidez at 127, so some question marks there. Not like he's been unprofessional in the past, not like weight misses have been a big issue.
But he is a huge guy for this weight class, and it is something that I'm always concerned with.
And much bigger than Kai Kara France in this fight. And that was the big talking point in Kara France's fight against Garbrandt was, wow, Garbrandt, you knew, like, you know, if he dialed it in, he could be a flyweight. Probably not the best time to do it after you get finished a lot of bantamweight, but you knew that he was going to be a bigger fighter. And for Kara France, he just, you know, once he figured out his range and where he could plant that overhand right, it was all she wrote.
But again, I go back, boxing and MMA have a lot more in common than people would like to admit. And go back to the Garbrandt fight. One of my more confident picks, the Kai Kara France, is going to be able to beat him. Because you have a guy who has a bad shin with a lot of losses at 135 who thought, hey, let's take another 10 pounds off my frame. Let's see if I'm more durable. It's like what I said about Dan Hooker. Dan Hooker moved weight one time. You can do it once. Then he did it twice, and we saw what happened. Like, it's not a good idea to keep on changing your weight because it's just such a last resort, it feels like, to switch your career up. Now, against Askar Askarov, he will be the much bigger guy. Askarov will be against Kara France. But he's going to oddly be the slower guy too. And that's the weird thing about this matchup. Askarov's going to have a lot of the benefits of being the bigger guy, but there's a lot of weaknesses that come along with that too. And again, this is sort of the boxing mindset of it, because who hits harder one punch for one punch? I know a lot of people are probably going to think Kara France, but just the way Askarov can lead guys into his straight shots, he hits pretty hard. I'm not ready to say Askarov hits harder the more I started thinking about that point. I'll say Kai Kara France is at least the faster guy, but they both have very respectable power on the feet. I keep on looking at this fight, though, and looking at all the Kara France matchups in the past. He always faces adversity, no matter what fight he is in. And yes, his record is a little salty. He's got quite a few losses for someone who has as many wins as he does. But when you look at Kara France, you kind of have to bring up Matt Brown, whose fight we just broke down. Like, when you fight the best of the best for the majority of your career, yeah, your record might not look great afterwards. But let's break down some of those fights. He had a really close fight with Brandon Moreno, and we're Brandon Moreno guys on this channel. I think we picked him to beat Figueiredo, what, two of the three times, if not all three? But that was a really close fight, and Moreno was able to land a lead head kick a lot off his combinations, but Kara France was able to stay very competitive later on into that fight, and ever since he has improved a lot. And then I go back to the Askarov fight against Moreno too. That was a weird fight, and I know it was a draw. I don't often say this. I felt like Brandon Moreno won that fight quite comfortably.
Most people did.
The last round, I felt, was a 10-8, because we've never really seen Askarov be controlled on the mat before. We've seen Kai Kara France get controlled on the mat many times. But with Askarov, that was weird, because that was the first time we had ever seen him in compromising positions on the mat. Again, not saying that's something that's going to come up in this fight, but it's never a position I thought we'd see him struggle in at the UFC level. So it was just sort of an interesting thing that we saw in that fight against Brandon Moreno. But again, we're talking about Brandon Moreno, former champion and one of the best grapplers in this division. I just think this fight's so much fun, because on the feet, could Askarov knock out Kara France? I mean, he could, but could Kara France knock out Askar Askarov like we saw Ilia Topuria knock out Jai Herbert? Yeah, and I think that's what makes this fight so much fun.
So you look at this one, and again, a few weeks ago for Askarov, he's been training at the PI, a couple of different rounds there with Otman Zaitsar, where are the potatoes? Pal Magomed Magomedov, hell of a fighter. You've got Albert Duraev, oddly enough, and Roman Dalidze. That picture was today. A few weeks ago, he's got Zuruk Adashev and Timur Valiyev there as well. He's also born deaf. and he can hear 20% of sounds, according to the internet now, and that's just absolutely crazy. I mean, to make it this far in the sport, former ACB champ, the reigning, the defending, he defended that belt a couple of different times. He has a Twister win on his record.
And when audible instructions from your coach during the fight are like a big part of the sport, like it just speaks to how good Asker really is.
Yeah, I mean, this guy can change up his game plan on the fly. If I have to strike a little bit more, 100%. He can do it. And that's the thing. Out of Askarov, he's under 30. He continues to get better at his striking. He's not near as good a striker as Kai Kara-France, but he continues to improve. And I love to see that. Like some people, you get to the big show and then all of a sudden, well, I'm good at this. I'm stagnant now and I never get any better. And I like what I've seen out of Askarov as his fights have gone on. I know we saw a diminished version of Joe B, and that was a retirement fight, and it didn't go well for Benavidez in that one. But the counter to it is Askarov did look really good in that fight. For Kai Kara-France, diminished value of Garbrandt, possibly, but Kara-France looked really good in that fight. And again, if I look at the last five fights for Kara-France, because he's a much more active guy, a loss to Moreno, a win over Tyson Nam, who happens to be a pretty good wrestler in his own right, that wild AF fight against Brandon Royval that he did lose, the wild AF fight against Sergio Bonturin.
From 10-8 to winning.
Yeah, that was really crazy. So ultimately, Matt, again, both these guys, very, very good. For Kara-France, definitely a better level of competition. That might sound weird. Better level of competition outside of the UFC. A loss to Mark Mugen-Striegel. A loss to Dana Bakari.
If they did that rematch today, though, I'm very confident Kara-France would win.
No way, Jose.
I know.
And then a loss to Pantoja on The Ultimate Fighter. But again, these are good fighters. They've all made it to the UFC, and Kara-France faced them outside of the UFC. So again, I absolutely love this fight, Matt. We talk about the odds here. Askarov, open to minus 200 favorite. Minus 327 is the comeback on best fight odds as of today. Kai Kara-France open plus 170 is plus 255. If we have a look at the topology votes, Matt, I'm going to switch it up. I'm going to say over under 60% Kai Kara-France.
I think Askarov will still be the favorite.
Nah, rats. 1,058 total votes, 79% Askarov, 81% by decision. For the 21% that have Kara-France, 67% by knockout. So again, people, not that torn, but kind of torn, I guess. Askarov, very much the favorite in this one. Honestly, again, Askarov with a win over Benavidez, I scratch my head. Maybe he gets a title shot. Kara-France knocks out Garbrandt. I know it's just a name. I know he's not in the division. But when you win a fight like that on a pay-per-view, like a big-time pay-per-view, I would have thought at least we're going to get consideration. And you consider it too. I mean, we've had big-time flyweight fights not that long ago. And then this one ends up like, you know, Askarov, UFC 259 against Benavidez. Kara-France, UFC 269 against Garbrandt. And now, on a Columbus fight night, these guys could be fighting in a title eliminator.
What's both guys' side piece Pantoja doing this whole time? Because it feels like he's the odd one out right now. Because in every division, there's always more than one person who has a claim to a title shot. You've got these fighters who feel like they're half a fight away, where it was like, okay, if the title wasn't booked right now, and if, you know, if the champion had no opponent, then maybe I could glide my way in there. Both of these guys are sort of in that position, and Pantoja himself could arguably say the exact same thing. He had a very close fight with Askarov, and honestly, if they made a five-round fight of Pantoja versus Askarov, I would be here for it. And Pantoja versus Kara-France would be one of the great fights in UFC. That's something everybody would be excited for. It just feels like he is the odd third wheel, because all three of these fighters, to me, do have a pretty good claim to getting the title shot. Although Askarov was able to beat Pantoja, and he's sort of the other one in this triangle, that would put him ahead of Kara-France, but this is a great fight, but this is the way I think this fight's going to go. Askarov is the more skilled fighter if we stack both guys' skills up next to each other. He's the better grappler. Defensively, I do worry about him a little bit, just because when he does throw his strikes, it does take him a little bit of time to bring his hands back. And against someone like Kara-France, his nickname's Don't Blink, and you don't get the nickname like Don't Blink by being slow as molasses. Like, Kara-France, when he decides to really throw his boxing combinations, there's not a lot that his opponents can do about it. And that's why I understand why Askarov's such a big favorite. I really do. Like, he is as talented as you could be in this division. But he's probably going to choose to strike until he's forced not to. And that's going to give Kara-France a great opportunity to win this fight, especially early. But if he isn't able to get that win early, we were able to see what Askarov was able to do to Benavidez as that fight went on. And like you said, Benavidez isn't near his prime. Not at all. But Askarov was able to build as that fight went on. And this is what I'll say. I wasn't sold on Askarov after the Benavidez fight. I don't think anybody in this division should be a minus 300 favorite over Kai Kara-France. But if Askarov's able to look good in this fight, I will be the number one person at the front of the line saying he deserves a title shot, because I will be completely sold.
So if there's like a line of salt near Vampire, can you go through the door? Are you picking Askarov, or are we staying outside?
So I think Askar Askarov's gonna win. And if he does look impressive, I don't know why he wouldn't get the title shot next. I understand he might not be the most marketable guy in the world, but you're fighting at flyweight. None of the fighters are all that marketable, if we're being honest right now. Like, Brandon Moreno and Deveson Figueiredo are unique because they had a very strong rivalry, and they're two strong personalities who can sell the fight. But outside of those two, there's not a lot of household names at this division, which... hopefully this fight is amazing and both these guys get a lot more notoriety. But I do have Askarov, even though I do think the odds should be closer.
Big time fight coming up this weekend for me as well. I have Askarov. Again, I don't love him at a minus 300. He opened minus 200. I wish it was still there. But when I look at this one again, Kaikar France has a great opportunity. He's speedy. He can mix in the kicks, but he doesn't fight kick heavy. He has good takedown defense, but Askarov is one of those guys that just continues and continues and continues and has one of those motors. So for me, I do like Askarov in this spot. His striking's improved, but he's nowhere near the striker of Kaikar France. But I really want to hear from the people because, again, Matt, we look at Tapology and what? 21% of the fans have Kaikar France. I know there's going to be a ton of strong support down there in the comment section. I want to hear from you because, again, you're not wrong until Saturday night. And then after Saturday night, people like to just step on what you pick. But a big time opportunity for both of these guys. And we're both going with Askarov in this fight.
Awesome fight, though.
Big time co-main event. Joanne Wood taking on Alexa Grasso. And in the main event, Curtis Blaydes, Chris Dawkins. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend in our co-main event at Women's Flyweight at a division that's absolutely on fire. We have Joanne Wood taking on the hyped, once hyped prospect, I guess, Mexico's Alexa Grasso. And for Grasso, she had a lot of success at strawweight, and then she met some resistance. I mean, the Tatiana Suarez loss, the loss to Carla Esparza.
Loss to Felice Herrig.
Very upper echelon fighters. Notice how I didn't really mention Felice Herrig, but you consider some of the wins. Karolina Kovalkiewicz, the win over Ji Young Kim, a win over Macy Barber last time out. And the move up to flyweight was an opportunity to get into a division that wasn't so top-heavy. So for Grasso, it's been a good move. She looked really, really good against Macy Barber. Great volume. Good job in the clinch. Good job defending some of those takedowns. I really, really liked what I saw out of Alexa Grasso a year ago. Yes, that fight was a year ago. So I'm eager to see, again, at 28, at this point in her career, what we can see out of Grasso because we know exactly her style. Again, takedown defense, on point. Boxing, good volume. You like to see it that way. When the takedowns are going through, again, Carla Esparza, Tatiana Suarez, so on and so forth.
It's a lot of lockdown.
Yeah, that much is true. For Joanne Wood, we pretty much know the book on her. I mean, again, Marina Moroz in her UFC debut submits her, wins a performance of the night bonus. Whoever would have thought that would have happened? Probably not me. But for Joanne Wood at 125, had a bit of a career resurgence and a lot of split decisions. But you look at the 5-1 in for her, a win over Andrea Lee by split, a loss to Jennifer Maia by submission. And really, when she beat Andrea Lee, she was in a title fight and then it was pulled away. And then she fought Maia, and then she lost that title shot. She goes out and
No. She was still guaranteed the title shot, decided to take the Maia fight, loses, and then lost her title shot. She didn't take that because she had to. She took that because she wanted to.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make. I guess our wires got crossed. But she fights Jessica Ai in a somewhat close fight, wins by decision, loses to Lauren Murphy by split decision, and then her last time out, fights Tyler Santos and loses quickly by submission. Tyler Santos gets a title shot. So, Matt, when it comes to this fight, Joanne Wood, I would say gatekeeper to the top five, and Alexa Grasso looking to make those moves and start those grooves before they knew we were gone. So, a good opportunity for Wood here. Will she be able to match the volume of Alexa Grasso at distance? Will she be able to get into that clinch, land those nice elbows, and live up to the old nickname of Dr. Knievel?
If Joanne Wood goes for a takedown before her UFC career is over, it's going to be in this fight. Because Alexa Grasso, and this is sort of the catch-22 in this fight, these are two of the worst defensive grapplers you will ever see in the UFC for where they are ranked in their division. Because here's the thing. Joanne Calderwood, at one point, was supposed to get a title shot against Valentina Shevchenko. But she has such a big weakness in her game, which is her overall grappling. And it's just never been a hole that she's been able to fix throughout her whole entire career. Now, I always bring up this point when we talk about Joanne Wood, and she has yet to prove me wrong. Like, an ideal Joanne Wood fight is still her winning by split decision. I always go back to this. Like, when we look up and down this card, for instance, when Kaikar France takes on Askar Askarov, I have a good idea as to what his game plan is going to be. It's going to be try to work in my leg kicks, work in my jab, flurry as fast as I can because I have a big speed advantage, and defend takedowns. We can both agree that's probably going to be his game plan. Joanne Wood, no matter who her opponent is I'm going to try to get into these, like, single collar tie clinches, almost like Daniel Cormier. Use my right elbow to land strikes. And against some fighters, it works just because they sort of lack the defensive ability to get out of that one spot. But if they don't, then she's just able to tee off on them. And even against Jessica Ai, who, again, is a title quality fighter in this division because, you know, both these women were supposed to fight Valentina. One of them, of course, fighting Valentina. That was a very close fight. And that just sort of told you where the women's flyweight division was as a whole. Right now, I do agree with you. We have a bit of a resurgence right now with some of the talent. But sort of the stagnant top five that's been there for a while is going to have to make some kind of an improvement if they ever do want to get over that Valentina hurdle. Because Joanne Wood's been talked about at the top of this division for a long time. Like you said, gatekeeper to the top five. There's other fighters like Jessica Andrade, Caitlin Chookagian, who are all sort of in this weird stasis in the top 10 right now. And we don't really know where any of their careers are going. So this fight is a huge opportunity for Grasso to really leapfrog sort of these older vets in the division and get her name at least close to a title shot, because that's the wildest thing about this fight. With Alexa Grasso coming off two wins, even though she's fighting someone who's lost two fights in a row and three of her last four, if Grasso looks impressive enough, she could probably get the winner of Santos versus Shevchenko. Like, that's how wide open this division is.
Yeah, and it really is. And I want to walk back for a second with Grasso on the takedown defense. Barbara was able to go three of, what was it, five in that fight. But again, I even see that as a net positive for Grasso. You're able to get back up to your feet. You're able to establish that volume once more. You're able to win that fight somewhat convincingly. And then I look at it, the fight of the night that she had against Esparza. Esparza is able to get the takedowns. Grasso is able to really work that volume game up on the feet. So will she be able to keep Joanne Wood away? That's what we're going to find out this weekend. The odds for this one, Wood open a plus 160. She's a plus 188 or thereabouts. For Grasso, open a minus 185, she's roughly a minus 230. We threw this out to you in the YouTube community tab. If you're subscribed, you'll see those pop up on your feed. You can
answer. If you're not, what are you doing?
Exactly. So we have a look at the votes. 612 total votes in the last 5 hours. You guys are quicker than Tapology. 79% with Alexa Grasso, who's ranked 11th in this division. Joanne Wood at 5, gatekeeping the top 6, I guess we could say. Out of those total votes and the comments, we have Alexa's layoff might give her a bit of an issue, but apart from that, I think her speed and hands will be too much for Wood, who hasn't been able to move her head too much in the past couple of fights. Michiganians say minus 210's good odds on Grasso here. First last saying Grasso is going to outpoint her from distance and has a massive speed advantage. Wood is going to clinch and Grasso will reverse, have a dirty clinch, tee off against the cage, break and repeat till Wood gets desperate again. And Drew Cliff with my favorite one out there saying Grasso's boxing should be the difference to stay out of the clinch and should dominate. Wood needs to close the distance and create close clinch situations, get the fight to the mat if she can, taking Grasso 100%. So Matt, the fans have Grasso. The odds have Grasso. We've talked a lot about Grasso. I have Grasso.
Quite comfortably, I think Grasso should be able to win this fight. Because for Joanne Wood, here's the question. What do you think she's improved on the most in her, like, UFC career? Because to me, she's that same. She was a Muay Thai champion before she came to the UFC, though. Like, she was good at that coming in. So
I was being a dingus there.
Answer the question then. She hasn't. That's the problem. Like, I can't point to a single thing that Joanne Wood does, and I think, wow, she's been able to improve tremendously in this. She looked great against Valerie Letourneau. That's the first women's flyweight fight in UFC history. They gave them sort of a weird special exemption before that division had ever been made. That's something I remember very well from that fight, and she destroyed Valerie Letourneau. And I really thought that that was going to sort of begin, at least a new beginning, if you will, for Joanne Wood, but it never did, and she did fall back into her old habits. So I do expect Grasso to be able to go out there and really evolve.
Both of us going with Mexico's Alexa Grasso in this matchup. Let us know down below in that comment section who you have in this fight. And in the main event at heavyweight, we have Razor Blades taking on Chris Daukaus. It's Kyle's brother. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up in our main event this weekend from Columbus. As always, one half of your host and duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP. The man sitting next to me, to my left, to your right, Matt Allen on the respective socials, at Matt Allen FNP. Very simple, very easy. Question mark kicks Also, with the acronym of QMK, that's live 2 hours before the prelims every single weekend, we get a final look back at the week that was and get to offer up those picks and predictions and the QMK parlay. So coming up this weekend in our main event, really trying to one-up last weekend's main event of Tom Aspinall and Alexander Volkov, trying to book a ticket to a possible interim heavyweight title fight because Francis Ngannou recently had surgery on one of them knees that was all, I guess, sleeved up here in his fight against Cyril Gane. We have Curtis Blaydes, we have Chris Daukaus. And for Daukaus, he's coming off an unceremonious loss to Derek Lewis where he got finished. His first loss in the UFC, his first loss since he fought for a title against Zhou Enyinwu over with CFFC. For Curtis Blaydes, he's coming off a fight where he got hit a few times by Jairzinho Rozenstruik. Before that, it was a fight against, a man that he had really had a little bit of beef with. You know, Derek Lewis.
Was a 3.5-1 favorite.
Got finished in that fight. Wild stuff. Uppercuts abound. But before that, wins over Volkov, JDS, and Shamil Durakhimov. You know anything about Curtis Blaydes? He's going to strike a little bit, and then he's going to wrestle. And he's going to go hot and heavy, and he's going to be all on top. And I'm going to stop right there.
Please do.
But you know what you're going to get out of Curtis Blaydes. And Chris Daukaus, the thing that I always come back to, he trains out of Martinez BJJ.
I'm concerned about what's in your notes about Curtis Blaydes after that line.
When it comes to Chris Daukaus, everybody talks about, well, again, we know that he's lighter for heavyweight. We know that he's fleet of foot, that his boxing's very good. We go back to, I don't know, pick any of his fights that we've seen so far in the UFC where he's come out on the winning end. The Abdurakhimov knockout, the Olenek knockout, the Nascimento fight, the fight against Parker Porter. I thought the Porter fight, like, he looked really speedy. He was able to evade. I really like what I've seen out of Daukaus in that respect. But when it comes back to jiu-jitsu, we just haven't seen it. And he doesn't have any wins by submission as a pro. Neither does Blaydes. But everybody likes to say, okay, well, he has Kyle Daukaus. Well, Brent Gretzky had Wayne Gretzky, and Brent played for the Danbury Trashers. And then you go through it, like, Tom Glavine was great with the Braves.
One of the all-time greats.
But, I mean, he also had a brother, Mike Glavine, who played in the majors and was a hitter, and he hit 143. I mean, he's a great NCAA coach right now in baseball, but, like, again, you're not as good as your brother. You never are. Like, there was Eric Lindros, there was Brett Lindros. Like, I can go on for days about this one, but with Chris, we just don't see the jiu-jitsu like we do see out of his brother.
And I've got a pretty big rule on this channel to where if I don't see it in the cage, I don't believe it's a thing. Not really. That is an over-exaggeration. But here's the thing. If you're this good at jiu-jitsu, why the hell don't we ever see it?
Because his hands are so good.
It doesn't matter, though. Like, even with Jose Aldo, one of the greatest strikers of all time, we at least saw some glimpses of his grappling, at least defensively, in most of his fights. Like, when guys would take him down, you could tell how good of a grappler he was just by how fast he'd get back up to his feet or just by how fast he could break your hands in the clinch. Chris Daukaus hasn't shown any of those skills throughout his career up until this point. And it's not like with a Tom Aspinall, who Tom Aspinall's Twitter name, hear me out, is Aspinall, followed by these three letters, BJJ. We all know what they stand for, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. That's how big of a part of his life BJJ has been. And we saw glimpses of it throughout his career up before he submitted Alexander Volkov. So you knew that, okay, if Aspinall can't box up his opponent in the back pocket, he's going to have this great jiu-jitsu. I don't doubt Chris Daukaus is a good grappler. I would just like to see it more. And the thing about Curtis Blaydes is, does he struggle against the upper echelon of heavyweight? Yeah, he does. He's been finished by Francis twice. He's been finished by Derek Lewis once. Those are two of those heavy-handed fighters, regardless of combat sport, we've ever seen.
Ever.
Ever. And the fact that Curtis Blaydes lost to those two knockout artists by knockout doesn't mean we have to completely write him off as a contender at this division. Do we know his limitations as a striker? I think we do. I don't think Curtis Blaydes is ever going to be able to go out there and thoroughly outstrike a top 10 guy for 15 minutes. I know he was able to knock out JDS, but that was an older JDS at that stage of his career, and a lot of his strikes were set up by the threat of the takedown, which against someone like JDS, he really has to respect that and put his hands down. If Daukaus is this great grappler, not even a great grappler, but just if Daukaus is comfortable off of his back, it will give him a lot of success in this fight because he won't be worried as much about the takedown attempts of Blaydes. And I really do think that when you're fighting someone like Curtis Blaydes, it's more of an exercise with your mentality more than anything. It's okay. I realize I'm here to wrestle. What am I going to do about that? If you're someone like Francis or Derek Lewis, you're going to figure out ways to time the uppercuts. You're going to figure out ways to land your big power shots because those are cerebral fighters. I know we like to look at Francis and look at Derek Lewis as, wow, they're just big knockout punchers. Like, no, they're really, really smart people too who are thinking about all this as they're setting up those knockout punches. I think Curtis Blades is the far more skilled fighter in this fight, but there's one thing about Blades that I absolutely hate, and it really cost him against Derek Lewis. Yes, he's a great wrestler. Are his entries very good, though? Not at all.
Very long.
They are, and that's always something that's really going to give him issue against the top-tier power punchers, because if you're a good wrestler, and if I know you're coming to wrestle, all I gotta do is meet you point A to point B at some point while you're going for one of those takedowns, and maybe I'm not strong enough to knock you out with one punch in the middle of the cage, but if you're meeting my punch halfway there, it's just gonna make me seem like that much more of a devastating puncher. So could I see Dawkins landing one of those short in-between punches? I definitely could, but the thing with Dawkins, like you had said, what's the thing that makes him special in the heavyweight division? It's his speed, it's his footwork, it's all those things that don't make him a traditional heavyweight. Well, to beat Curtis Blades, I actually think you do need to be a traditional heavyweight, and that's why I like Blades so much in this matchup.
Well, you have a look at it for Chris Dawkins. He's coming off a 5-round main event that did not go 5 rounds.
Not long ago.
2 months ago against Derek Lewis, he gets finished. His first UFC loss for Curtis Blades. His fight against Derek Lewis, for what it's worth, was a year ago. His fight against Jairzinho Rozenstruik was about 5 months ago. Curtis Blades has fought in many a main event with the UFC. And what's the highlight of his UFC career? Probably the win over Overeem.
And that's the thing that I keep on going back to. His third round ground and pound against Alistair Overeem is some of the most vicious, like, the elbows that he landed from guard. And that's the thing. Most of them you have to pass guard. Because, again, if you watch MMA, what's so important about guard? Well, guard my legs, half my body, I can use them offensively, defensively. Curtis Blades, in a lot of his fights, will just lay and pray. Let's just tell it like it is. He's not the most exciting grappler of all time. But in that one fight, we saw just behind the curtain a little bit, and it was one of those violent shows we've ever seen behind that curtain. It would be nice if Curtis Blades would show that side of him again, because he's not a devastating puncher on the feet. He's a big guy who has improved stand-up, but again, not a great knockout puncher by any means. Not a true submission threat. Again, he's someone who really does have to rely on his takedowns and just overall consistency throughout a fight. I think we did see that aggressive ground and pound side of Curtis Blades again. That's how he could get himself back up to a title shot. I don't know if we are ever going to see that version of him, but I do think that if Curtis Blades can just wrestle for 5 rounds, he should be able to beat Chris Dawkins, which is wild to say, because I thought Dawkins was going to beat Derek Lewis.
When you look at it for Chris Dawkins, too, I mean, great pop at the end of his shots. He's a guy that can really throw those long-range straight shots and find a home for them, pressure right up against you, get the win, get the finish. Obviously, his fight against Shamil Dirkimov, a knockout, Parker Porter, and we go through them. He's been so impressive in the UFC. We have a look at Fight Night Picks, threw this out there in the community tab. If you're subscribed, you're going to get that on your feed. But we throw these polls out here because we want to hear from you. But also, we definitely read your responses. We do care what you have to say about these. So 1,500 total votes.
We're doing it right now.
For the number 4 ranked, Curtis Blades, 74% of the fans going with him. For the number 8 ranked, Dawkins, 26%. We go over into that comment section. And for LJ, he says, LJ says, they say, I genuinely feel like Blades is a dark horse in the division, but he comes up short sometimes.
He's like Dillian White. He's been the number one contender for 6 years now. So at a certain point, Curtis Blades has got to get his opportunity.
We have Philip KCA Calloway saying, this is a tough one for me to pick. I love watching both these guys. Kurt has more juice, though, and crazy fast hands. And that much is true. It Could Happen 21 saying, from a London card where you couldn't miss picks if you tried, to a card where it's a who's who. Definitely need the boys for this one. That sounds like I'm just patting myself on the back. But It Could Happen 21, thanks for picking us up. So far, I like Max Payne for the KO and Olenek to get the sub for his 60th and retire. I like Dawkins in the main, but I don't know if Blades can control him and hold him down. It'll be interesting. Askarov and Kai for my fight of the night. Last saying, Blades striking is becoming more refined and should really be able to neutralize Dawkins in the clinch. Curtis via lay and pray a la John Fitch. So Matt, the odds for this one, I want to make sure I throw those ones out there. Curtis Blades is a pretty big favorite. Open to minus 300, roughly a minus 367. For Dawkins, open to plus 250, plus 282. And I mean, Matt, I think Chris Dawkins is a hell of a fighter. I don't think 2 months after you lose to Derek Lewis, you should fight Curtis Blades.
Okay, James Harden isn't good in the playoffs or when games matter. But if you just look at his playoff resume, he lost the Miami Heat in 2012 in the finals. He's lost to Golden State. Like, it's like, okay, those are all forgivable losses. You kind of make the same excuse for Curtis Blades. You lost to Francis twice, and you've lost to Derek Lewis in one of the most vicious ways possible. Those are all forgivable losses, and those are fighters who don't fight anything like Chris Dawkins. Again, Dawkins relies on his hand speed, and he does get knockouts, but he sets them up with his speed and with his volume, and he finds openings through your defense, more as just relying on the force of one big shot. I can see Chris Daukaus actually boxing up Curtis Blaydes as this fight goes on, similar to how Rozenstruik was able to against Blaydes, because you have to remember, Blaydes didn't do anything in the top position in that fight, but he was able to secure takedowns. What happened when the fight was on the feet, though? Jarzynski was having quite a bit of success. He landed that big flying knee that I still have no idea how Curtis Blaydes was able to eat, but, this honestly is a closer fight, I think, than the odds would suggest, but I do think Curtis Blaydes can be able to get it done. We've never seen him get out-grappled in a UFC fight, and that really is important. We've seen him get out-struck by the most powerful strikers to ever walk the face of the earth. We've never seen him get out-grappled, and I don't think Chris Daukaus is going to be the first guy to do it.
That's the one. I mean, listen, Brent has Wayne, or Wayne has Brent, and Chris has Kyle, but when I look at this one, I haven't seen it out of Chris Daukaus. I do believe his jiu-jitsu is great. I know. I see it on Instagram. I see it here. I see it there. I've talked about it his whole entire run up to this point. But I have a hard time seeing him finishing Curtis Blaydes on the mat. So for me, I like Curtis Blaydes. He has that Hall of Fame badge takedown ability that you like to see in this division. Everybody has to have something. For him, it's the takedowns. For Francis, it's the power. For Tom Aspinall...
No, for Francis, it's the takedowns, Craig.
Well, for Tom Aspinall, he has all of the gemstones. So we'll see what happens there. But for me, I do have Blaydes in this one. But I'd love to hear some more of the comments that are going on over there in that community tab. Because again, you folks have 74% of you going with Blaydes at a 1,500 total votes. It's way more than the Tapology votes. And we'd definitely love to hear from you. Let us know down below on these videos who you have. Toss a like. Subscribe if you haven't, because it really does help out the channel. And in 2022, it's really been taking off again this year, and we love to see it, and it's all thanks to you guys. So thank you so much for the support this year.
And if you enjoyed these prediction videos, like Craig had said earlier on, we do have one last look at the fights. It normally starts 2 hours before the fight night start. It's a show called Question Mark Kicks. It's a great time. Again, just gives us one last chance to go through the card. If there are any weight misses, any, you know, last chance switches, that's where we get the chance to talk to you guys about it, answer some of your questions. It's always a lot of fun over there.
It gets rowdy in that comment section. Is just it really moves. So check out Question Mark Kicks 2 hours before the prelims on Saturday. A big time card coming up from Columbus. You don't say that very often. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it.